early question.
Okay.
I'd like to call to order the May meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Welcome. It has been an extremely busy 30 days since last we met. We have a very, very busy agenda with actually two public hearings this evening. And beginning right at 5, there will be a hearing on the subdivision street acceptance standard. That is not a CTB public hearing. That is a VDOT public hearing. You're, of course, welcome to attend. My guess is if you look at the length of and the depth of the issues on the work session, we may not complete everything by 5 o'clock. And so what I will propose, particularly for those members of the media who are here, we'll be moving into the back room where they have some dinner set aside for us, maybe at 5:30. And I want to listen a little bit to the subdivision street standards presentation. And we can continue, if there are uncompleted work session items, we could continue those discussions in there. And, of course, that room will be open to the public. Now, we will not have the benefit of nice audiovisual presentations, so don't get alarmed back there. But I just think we have, again, a very ambitious schedule of work session, two public hearings tonight. We've got to complete by time certain our work set, our business and action agenda tomorrow morning. We have the ribbon cutting for the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, the second span of the Wilson Bridge. God willing, we won't be stuck in bus and the shutdown of I-95 as we were at the Springfield Interchange opening. But we've got to pay attention to the clock today and tomorrow to meet our requirements. Any questions? If not, what I would like to do is introduce our first speaker. We're very honored today to have Mr. Jack Schenendorf here with us today. Mr. Schenendorf spent 25 years as the professional staff to what is today called the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure for the House of Representatives. No one knows more about highways, transit, pipelines, demand management than Mr. Schenendorf. And he's here to talk about a very important commission that he serves on and that he brings not only historical perspective, but I think a vision for surface transportation throughout the country. Jack is now in private practice, and I suspect, given that you have to spend a lot of time traveling across the river and coming to talk to groups like us, that is a very important part of your work. This is volunteer work, and we really appreciate your continuation of public service, Mr. Schenendorf, your willingness to share your wisdom and your experience with us today. So Mr. Schenendorf will run through his presentation. Would you like people to just raise their hands if they have questions going along, or do you want to wait to the end, whatever is?
It doesn't matter, whatever you all are comfortable with. If you have a question that's going along, you may answer it.
Okay. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. When they asked me to go through this presentation that I had made to ASHTO, it reminded me a story of one of our members used to tell from Minnesota, and not Chairman Oberstar. This was a member that preceded him. And this member of Congress was out. It was election season, and he was out going around Minnesota making speeches. And one night the weather was bad, and he came to this local high school for a speech, and it turns out there was only one gentleman in the audience. He was a rancher, local rancher. And so he went down to him and said, you know, you want to go get a cup of coffee, and we'll just chat. And the rancher said, well, you know, when the weather is bad and I've got to go out and feed the animals, I take my truck out, if only one animal shows up, I still feed it. And so the congressman said, okay, and he goes back up to the podium and he gives his standard 40-minute speech. And when he's all done, he goes down and talks to the rancher and says, you know, well, what'd you think? And he said, well, I guess I should have told you, when only one animal shows up, I don't feed it the whole truckload. Unfortunately, I think you're going to get the whole truckload. I'll try to go through this pretty quickly because this presentation is goes through the all of the commission's activities. It started, the commission was established by Section 1909 of Safe T. Lou. I think most of you are probably familiar with what a difficult bill that was. It had 12 extensions, was over 2 years late. And in order to try to make things a little easier in the next cycle, which is going to be in 2009 because the bill expired in September 30th of 2009, so there'll need to be a new bill. In order to make that process a little bit easier, they established a 12-member commission to try to come up with a blueprint for what the next bill should look like in order to help Congress and kind of give them a head start and hopefully make the process a little bit smoother. We held hearings around the country, talked to a lot of experts, including people from Virginia, in trying to develop what we thought was going to be the problems and some solutions for how to deal with it. We basically finished our report in January of this year, and we have been out testifying on Capitol Hill and traveling throughout the country, letting the American people know what it is that we found. And the first thing is that we are in a transportation crisis, so you all know that from the work that you do here in Virginia, but this is a national crisis. We have been very blessed in the history of this country with some great leaders who have recognized the importance of transportation. Whether you look back at Thomas Jefferson and his recognition of the need for roads and canals, Abraham Lincoln with the Transcontinental Railroad, Teddy Roosevelt with the Panama Canal, Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower with the interstate system. These were men of vision who put transportation systems in place that have helped develop this country and make this country what it is. In the last 30 to 40 to 50 years, we have really benefited from the initiatives of Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower with the interstate system, and the fact that our rail system had excess capacity in it, and once it was deregulated, that excess capacity really became available. And the excess capacity, the new interstate, the excess capacity that was built into the interstate, the excess capacity in our freight rail system helped really drive this economy and really make this country what it is today. Transportation costs have been falling through this period. It's made us the leading competitor in the world, and it's really helped make our nation what it is today. Well, those days are over. The interstate system that we were handed, new and debt-free, is now an aging system with segments that have to be replaced. Nobody knows that better than you with the mixing bowl and with the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. And it's also at capacity in many locations. And the same with our freight rail system. Our freight rail system is aging. Our freight rail system has got capacity problems. And they're only going to get worse. And so our basic finding was that we are really at a crisis. We've become very complacent. We've had these systems over the last 30 to 40 years, but now they're inadequate. They threaten our international competitiveness. They threaten our economic prosperity, and it threatens our way of life. And we really need to do something about it, and we need to act now. The crisis, and I'll quickly go through this, basically we looked at it as having three elements, underinvestment crisis, a policy crisis, and a financing crisis. And the underinvestment, we have 150 million additional people expected in the United States over the next 50 years. Many of them will be gravitating to these 10 so-called mega regions, and we'll be stressing our systems, which are already aging and already at capacity. This is a graphic I like to use. It looks at the freight between now and 2020 and the huge growth. The factoid that I like to use that we heard was that in order to keep up with the freight that's going to be coming into this country, we have to build another port of Seattle every year for the foreseeable future. We have to add that much port capacity every year to keep up with the growth in freight. And, of course, all that freight then has to move on the surface system and for just further compounding the problems we already have. This is the freight rail system. If you look on the left, you'll see what it's like in 2006. You've got some yellow, which is a little slowdowns. You've got a little bit of red. But look what our freight rail system looks in 2035. With the growth in freight that's projected to come. So the upshot of all this is that we have enormous needs. About half of the needs relate to rebuilding, reconstructing our aging systems, our aging rail and highway systems. Again, with the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, the Springfield Interchange, you know that. And then the other half of the needs are for new capacity that's going to be needed to keep up with the 150 million new Americans and with the growth in freight that's projected. Our analysis showed that we need to be investing $225 to $340 billion per year at all levels of government in the private sector to meet these needs. We're currently investing about $87 billion a year at all levels of government. So we have a huge investment gap. We also have a policy crisis. It's not just underinvesting. It's the policies involved. And then that
large investment, which I don't doubt for a minute, but is there any new and different direction anticipated in transportation in 21st century, or is it redoing the existing system and making it better?
Well, I mean, I'll get into that with our recommendations of the way that we propose. But basically, we need all of the above. We need all of our transportation systems upgraded. We need to put our systems in a state of good repair. We need increased highway capacity. We need increased transit. We need increased intercity passenger rail. And we need increased freight rail capacity, all of them working together to try to meet this challenge.
Thank you.
In the policy side, we have really two main crises. The first is that the federal program has really lost its sense of purpose or mission. When I started on the Transportation Committee in the mid-70s, somebody asked me what the federal program was trying to do. We were basically trying to complete the interstate system. Since that system was completed, the program really doesn't have a defined mission, and it's more like a transportation revenue sharing program. We also have a problem with project delivery. Federal rules, federal regulations, federal red tape just adds to the time it takes to construct these projects, drives up the costs, and we need to do something about that. This policy crisis, a combination of the two, has really led to some very difficult things. The first is the donor-donee. When I started on the committee, you were building the interstate system, you had a national sense of purpose. States weren't fighting amongst themselves over the donor-donee. But if you're in a transportation revenue-sharing mode and there's no overriding national purpose, then every state wants to get back every penny it pays in. And so you've got the donor-donee issue. Members of Congress, if there's no national focus to the program that they can go home and talk about, then they want earmarks. So they can go home and talk about earmarks. There weren't any when I started on the committee. And Safety Lou had over 6,000. We identified 100, putting aside all of the earmarks, we identified 108 programs, funding streams in all of the federal programs. Well, if you have 108 priorities, you don't have any priorities. It's that simple. And then another criticism that we heard is that there's insufficient flexibility. You get programs in these categories, you've got to use it for those purposes, and sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't work. In addition to the underinvestment, in addition to the policy crisis, there's a financing crisis at the federal level. I'm sure you've probably all seen this graph of the balances in the Highway Trust Fund and the Highway and Transit accounts all going down, and basically those trust funds cannot support the existing levels of funding as we go forward in the future. The problem has been a loss of purchasing power. The 18.4-cent federal gas tax has been that since 1993, and it just hasn't kept up with inflation. We have a trust fund deficit that's coming in 2009, cash deficit. The program, and if you just extend the taxes, this will be the first bill since 1956 where if you extended the taxes at the federal level, you couldn't have a slightly bigger program. And this year, this coming bill, if you extend the taxes, the program would actually have to be cut by about 20 to 30% in order to live within the existing revenues. That's never been the situation before, and that's going to be one big complicating factor when Congress goes to reauthorize the program. And, of course,
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat that last statement? Because for members of this body, when we look at transit and highways, and one of the assumptions and for new capacity is predominantly federal funding. We're going to hear a little bit about the Dulles Rail Project. Our construction program is well over 60% on the highway side federal dollars. In that last statement you just made about just continuing the existing program is worth repeating and everybody thinking about.
If the safety lieu, there was a deliberate decision, conscious decision made to fund the programs at levels above what the trust fund could support long term, and they were able to do that because there was a big balance in the trust fund. So basically they drew the balance down over time. But what that means at the end of the bill is that the balance is down to zero, so now you have to live with the incoming revenues, and that would be about a 20-30% reduction below the safety lieu funding levels if Congress doesn't do anything about it. And it was deliberate in order to force that crisis. They had trouble getting additional revenues, and so they decided, let's force the Congress to deal with the issue in this fashion, and that was to basically deplete the trust fund of all of its revenues and force a decision in this next bill. Now, even if we get up to the safety funding levels, even if we solve that problem, we still have a huge problem because that's the $87 billion a year at all levels of government. What we were saying is you've got to get up to at least $225 billion a year at all levels. So the gas tax, the taxes that are currently coming into the trust fund are not sufficient to keep the current levels of funding, much less the increased levels of funding that are needed. So our commission basically agreed on all that I just mentioned, and the question is, well, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to recommend? And we basically had two different perspectives within the 12-member commission. One perspective, and basically this chairperson of the commission was the Secretary of Transportation, and she and a couple of the other members of the commission really thought that started off with the approach of we ought to devolve the program to the states, just get the federal government out of it, let the states collect the revenues at the state level and deal with the problems at the state and local level. And between state and local governments and the private sector, we can solve this problem. They evolved over time to say, well, we can keep the 18.4 cents tax there, the federal tax, let's keep that and let each state get back what it paid in, but everything else falls to the state and local governments and the private sector. And when really pushed as to what the real proposal was, it really was to price the system through the private sector, turn as much of the roads over to the private sector as possible, let them price, congestion price, to keep the demand down in those roads and to make the roads so that they would be sufficient flow on them, that freight and people would be able to move. But there are some people who would be priced off the system, obviously. That's what congestion pricing is. It's pricing the most vulnerable people in society off the road because they wouldn't be able to use it. And it also has a number of other issues associated with it. There wouldn't be money for transit. There wouldn't be money for inner-city passenger rail in this kind of approach. So this was a reduced federal role approach. The other perspective that commissioners brought to the table was basically, no, this is a national problem. It needs a national solution. The federal government needs to be a full partner. The private sector can be helpful, but it can't solve the whole problem. We need government to be part of the solution, and the federal government needs to be a part of that. The outcome was that we had to agree to disagree. We really did work hard to try to get a consensus, because obviously a 12-member commission, if we all agreed, would have more weight, but we couldn't. And the secretary, the former deputy secretary, Maria Sinow, and another presidential appointee, a professor from Cornell, basically dissented. and nine of the commissioners approved the report and all of the recommendations in it. Of those nine commissioners that approved it, five were Republican, four were Democrat, included the CEO of a national of Burlington Northern Railroad, it included the CEO of a major trucking company, included the CEO of Office Depot that uses the system, included state Secretary of Transportation for Wisconsin, a local official from San Francisco. So it was a very diverse group. Paul Weyrich approved them, from very conservative to very liberal, five Republicans, four Democrats, a bipartisan group approved the report. But the Secretary of Transportation dissented with two others. The recommendations were, on the investment side, we have to increase the investment significantly. We have to close that investment gap as a nation, and all levels of government and the private sector have got to work together to get up the level of investment up into the $225 billion range, and that the federal government needs to be a full partner in that, not doing the whole thing itself, but with state and local governments and the private sector. We also recommended major program reform. We said, first, the federal program has to have a vision restored to it. The federal government in this next bill needs to identify what it is the federal government's trying to accomplish and make that clear and give the program a sense of purpose. What we recommended that be is we recommended that the 108 programs that exist today be replaced with 10 performance-driven, outcome-based, generally modally neutral programs. And I'll go into what those are in a second, but that's our basic recommendation. In addition, we included a NASTRAC recommendation that would be something similar to the Postal Rate Commission that would force Congress to actually vote on providing the funding for the programs that it says it's going to fund. And then we also have recommendations in there to fix project delivery without weakening environmental requirements, getting the time down to a reasonable time for a decision of a few years rather than 12, 13, 14 years. The programs, this is a little hard to read, but I know you've got copies on your in your folders. One of the programs that we're recommending as performance-based would be a state of good repair program where we would basically be saying our existing infrastructure needs to be brought up into a state of good repair and kept in a state of good repair. It's very hard to go to the American people and ask them for all sorts of new stuff if the stuff we have is falling apart. And so that ought to be the premise and that ought to be the starting point for any transportation program. In addition, we're recommending a program that would reduce fatalities by 50% by 2025. A program that would reduce congestion in major metropolitan areas of a million or more by 20% by 2025. A program that would provide for the smooth flow of freight to improve our international competitiveness. An access and mobility program for rural areas and smaller cities of less than a million. And the only modally, those would all be modally neutral. The only program that really wasn't modally neutral was an inner-city passenger rail program in about 16 of the densest corridors in the United States from 300 to 500 miles. Our analysis showed that you could not solve the congestion problems in those corridors without world-class, high-speed passenger rail that people wanted to take. And if you got that in there, then you could had a chance of dealing with the congestion in those corridors. And you also helped with the aviation situation. It's an absolute sin that people are flying from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia or from Washington, D.C. to New York when our air traffic control system can't handle the real long-distance travel. And so these 16 corridors of 300 to 500 miles, we recommend to be upgraded with inner-city passenger rail that was world-class. We had four other programs relating to research, federal lands, energy and environment, but these would be the major operative programs. The way that they would work is they're all performance-based. This is a very threatening concept to public officials because instead of just building a highway or building a transit system, you would actually have to solve a transportation problem, and you would actually have to be focusing on congestion or access. And the way that it would work is that if Congress adopted what we recommended, the first step would be for the federal government, state and local governments, and the stakeholders to develop standards and metrics for how we're going to measure that performance standard. You would then, each state would, once they had the metrics, each state would go and say, well, here's what we have to do to meet these performance standards, these metrics. And they would develop their plans for how that would be done, and that would have to be a transparent process with people involved in dealing with how are we going to reduce congestion in a metropolitan area by 20%. Then you would have cost estimates developed on what was in these plans, and then you would fund it on a cost-to-complete basis the way the interstate system was. And at every step, government would be accountable to the people. People would actually be able to understand what was being proposed, and then they would be able to monitor whether it was being successful or not, as people were with the interstate system. Congress and government made a promise to people they were going to build this system, and people could see it being built. They could see the gaps, and they knew when it was finished. And this would restore the program to that kind of mechanism where people could actually see and understand what was coming and hold government accountable for delivering. With respect to financing, this is obviously going to be a very costly proposition. We started off with some general principles. We endorsed the user fee financing. We thought that in the best of all worlds, we would be able to fund this from the users and not have the general fund have to fund any of the transportation improvements. Secondly, we thought that there should not be any diversion. Some of these deals that have been made, the Chicago Skyway, what Governor Corzine was talking about, the New Jersey Turnpike, involves lots of generating lots of revenues, but then not using it on transportation, using it on some other function, such as home heating oil in Chicago, or paying off the state debt in New Jersey. And we came down on the side of the needs in transportation are so great that any money that we generate from transportation ought to stay in transportation, be used in transportation, and preferably in the corridors from which it's generated. Our feeling was you wouldn't get the support of the public without that kind of linkage. And then third, we endorsed the funding guarantees that were placed in law in T21. In financing, in the short term, we basically made a series of recommendations for Congress on how to fix the deficit in the trust fund that occurred in 2009. In the interim term, from now until we estimated about 2025, the gas tax is more than ample to get the job done. I mean, it's got long-range problems. But in the short term, in this interim period, it can get the job done. We basically recommended an increase of 25 to 40 cents in the federal gas tax over a five-year period. So that's 5 to 8 cents per gallon per year for 5 years. A freight fee, we recommended that part of the customs fees be diverted to the trust fund and that there be a passenger ticket tax on transit and rail so that they're paying into the system. It's not going to pay for all the transit improvements, but nevertheless, as users, they should be paying into the trust fund if there's a user pay principle. At the state and local level, we basically say we need to allow tolling for new capacity on the interstate, lift the federal prohibition. So if you're going to add lanes to the interstate, you can do that through tolling. We recommended that we lift the prohibition and allow congestion pricing on existing lanes of the interstate. Our studies showed that regardless of how you did the performance standards and how much transit you put in and how much highway construction, there were some corridors, especially in our dense urban areas, where you could not get traffic down to a reasonable level without having some congestion pricing. And so that will be in the future, we believe, part of the solution that metropolitan areas have to use in order to get an acceptable level of transportation. And we felt that private investment was key to this, that we needed to have the private sector participating and helping out in this, and so we basically, for tolling, congestion pricing, and the private sector involvement, basically recommended that all of those be part of the solution, as long as they're done in ways that are consistent with the public interest in the long term. Now, in the long term, probably 2020, 2025, 2030, who knows, if we can solve the problems with the VMT tax, then we should shift over to that. There are significant privacy issues, collection issues, evasion issues associated with the VMT tax, but we recommended basically that Congress go down the path of doing everything we can to transition to that as soon as we can, and we recommended studies and pilot programs that were we were told was the way to get this to happen as quickly as we can and see if it works. Obviously, as we get into replacement fuels, if there's one replacement fuel of hydrogen, you could tax that the way you tax motor fuel today, but we don't really know what that's going to look like, how many replacement fuels they're going to be, is it going to be subject to being taxed. So we need to be on a parallel track looking at that as well. The next steps in all of this, those are our basic recommendations. On the financing side, our recommendations were really all of the above, that you have to use the motor fuel tax, you have to use these other fees, you have to use tolling, you have to use congestion pricing, and you have to use private sector. And you have to use them together. You have to be smart about it. You've got to make sure they're in the public interest. It's not going to be easy to take all of those different things and make them work together. But if you do the performance plans the way we were talking about, that will have the effect of showing people why things are happening, why the transportation system is being designed the way it is, and why it's being paid for the way it is. So people will understand it. They will understand what the alternatives would have been. And I think people will then be much more accepting of a congestion pricing project or a tolling project or an increase in the gas tax, because they'll see how it relates and what they're getting for it. And all of these together will produce, with the federal government leading in many respects with funding, will basically mean that we'll have from a national perspective, we'll have upgraded the system in order to meet the needs of the 21st century. But make no mistake, if we are going to do for our children and grandchildren what our parents and grandparents did for us, we need an effort comparable to what Eisenhower did in the 50s. Just a little more funding and a little less time isn't going to get the job done. We can't nibble at the edges of this. We have to fundamentally say we've got a huge challenge here, recognize it, and have leaders show up that are capable of basically putting a vision like this in place. As I mentioned before, the reauthorization, I won't go into the details of what we can talk about it, but it's going to be a very difficult reauthorization under any circumstances, even if it had been a routine one. And this, in our judgment, can't be a routine one, so that's going to make it an even bigger effort and a bigger problem to deal with. The commission is going to go around and try to spread the word, so to speak, on our findings and our report as much as we can over the next 12 to 18 months. But there are critical next steps. The administration, Congress, state DOTs, stakeholders have all really got to step up to the plate and really educate people to a degree that they haven't been in the past. The last bill I worked on was T21, which basically provided the funding guarantees. When that started, we were told it was going to be impossible to do what we wanted to do. And we built a coalition. A lot of it was an inside the Beltway coalition. Groups like yourselves were all part of that. And we were able to accomplish it. We went around the country with some visits. But what we're talking about now is an order of magnitude greater challenge than that was, because here we really have to educate the public. We have to educate other people in society that typically don't get involved in transportation, and they let the transportation gurus deal with it. But this problem is too big now. We have to build up support the way the public supported the interstate system. And that was simple because in retrospect. It was a map. People could see the map, and they saw a picture of a four-lane divided road. They were driving on two-lane crowded roads and said, yeah, that's what we want. And so it was kind of easy to sell that in retrospect. Here, it's much more complicated. The solutions are multimodal. It's how the system works together. It's how everything has to be blended together to make it work. And so it's going to be much more difficult to explain. But I think all of us are going to have to not only talk to each other, but get out and talk to the American people and talk to others in business and who have an interest in this, but don't necessarily realize it. And so in conclusion, we are at a crossroads. We have to act now, and we have to do for the next generation what former generations have done for us, really, with the systems that we were given. And we were given the interstate system, not only new, we were given the interstate system debt-free. We're not still paying on the interstate system. And those were two huge gifts, and our country benefited from those greatly, and we need to do the same thing for our kids. And one of the things that, you know, transportation isn't sexy, as you all know, and it's hard to get attention, and you go to the legislatures and you're competing, and you know, they take a poll, and you know, you can't even find transportation in the poll if it's even on there to ask people. It usually falls below some of these other key items that people are interested in. But the point I like to make is that whatever it is that people want to do, whether you're a conservative or whether you're in the middle of the road or whether you're a liberal and you've got ideas of what government should do and how government should spend its money and what challenges we face as we go forward, all of those things cost money, and it requires a healthy economy in order to make any of those things become a reality. And you can't have a first-class economy with a second or third-class transportation system. If there's anything we should understand, it's that when you look around the world and you look at developing countries, it's their lack of infrastructure, their lack of transportation that holds them back. And if we don't change, we're headed for a second or third-rate transportation system if we don't change things around now. And if we do change them around and we have that healthy growing economy, then we can have the debate on all of the good other things to do. If our economy becomes a second or third rate, we won't have that debate because we won't have money for the very basics, much less doing all the nice to do things that we want to do as a nation for our people. So with that, thank you, and I'll be more than pleased to answer any questions.
And thank you, Mr. Sanador, for a great
sorry you got the whole truckload.
No, but you know, it is so timely for where the Commonwealth is, and so many of the phrases you've used in your presentation I've heard the last couple of days with Governor Kane going around the state talking about global competitiveness, talking about regionalism, talking about multimodal, talking about change, and talking about deficits. And so one of the key features of Governor Kane's plan is to address the maintenance deficit in our transportation system. You pointed out the very real and growing deficit in the Federal Highway Trust Fund. And that's a fact, I think, not well known or well appreciated by the general public. So thank you for pointing that out. Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shenandoah, I just want to echo Secretary Homer's thanks for being here today. Very much appreciated. In Virginia, we have begun to recognize that part of this huge accruing liability or deficit, whatever you want to call it, at least partly, if not completely, stems from the fact that, to put it simply, we live and work too far away from each other, and that the sprawl in and of itself is an additive factor to that liability. And so we have begun in Virginia to do some things legislatively that aggressively push local municipalities, other decision makers, to start to figure out ways to live and work closer together. It strikes me that the federal government, with the huge power of the purse that it holds over transportation in this country, could be a huge factor in stimulating that kind of change. And you mentioned in your comments that part of the problem from your perspective is this lack of overall vision. And I guess my question is, did the commission spend any time looking at the impact of land use patterns on the accruing liability and the ability to impact the size of that liability by using federal policy to aggressively change land use patterns in a world where the climate's getting warmer and gas costs $4 a gallon?
We did. That was a part of our discussions and part of our debate. But one of the things that's beautiful about this country is it is so diverse. And so, you know, what works in State A doesn't necessarily work in State B. And there are some areas that shouldn't be growing. There are other areas where growth may be a necessity or people may want it. What we think is that the way that we have structured the program will require significant changes in land use planning. Just take the Washington, D.C. area, and if what we recommended passed, the Washington, D.C. area would be told that basically it needs to come up with its plan on how to reduce congestion by 20% from today's levels by 2025 in the face of growth that's coming. Well, you very quickly, when we did our analyses, when we did our modeling, you start off with, well, let's build our way out of it. Let's just build some more highways and build transit. And it doesn't do it. You've got to do land use. You've got to do new, innovative things. And that's one of the benefits, we think, of it, is that it would unleash a tremendous amount of innovation, and it would have people in there so that if you do impose land use requirements and restrictions, it would have been done through a transparent process because this is what we have to do to get to this transportation goal that we have. And people would understand the linkages much better. And so we think that what we're recommending will not only result in tremendous changes in land use, it will result in other innovations because that's what areas are going to have to do to meet those kinds of aggressive targets for congestion.
Thank you.
Ms. Coleman.
Thank you. Mr. Schoendorf, thank you for being here, too. If you need some help helping the Secretary of Transportation change her mind, we might volunteer our Deputy Secretary, who seems to have had some success in that regard recently. I have 2 points that I'd like to ask you about. Number one, certainly vision and sense of purpose are important. For the private sector, if you're looking for a major source of new investment, it's really the value proposition you're talking about. And I think even as recently as last night at our own governor's meeting, it's clear that every American should have to pass an economics 101 course because there just is no understanding of the cause and effect, the investment, the return on investment, and so forth. My specific question for you, though, has to do with your discussions, if any, about what it would take to encourage greater private investment. Some of the ideas, for example, a national infrastructure corporation or infrastructure bank or infrastructure insurance company, something that actually takes these projects that we know cost a lot of money and makes them creditworthy projects that actually the private sector would be willing to invest in. Did you all have specific discussions about those new institutions or structures that might be needed?
Not specifically. We envision the private sector being involved in maybe to the extent that you're talking about through this. But we tried to structure as much as you could a pay-as-you-go system. And that, in the long run, that is the way to produce the benefits and to produce these investments in transportation to the maximum extent that we could. We tried to go toward a pay-as-you-go type of system, and where the private sector can come in with capital and is willing to do it on some of these projects, then so be it. Then you know there should be, and we definitely see that there are a lot of projects that the private sector would be good at. But we didn't try to come up with ways to kind of change the system to make projects that they really weren't interested in more interest to them. because in the long run, that involves a lot of debt that would have to be paid back. I mean, you look at some of these projects with debt financing out for 80, 100 years. I mean, that's tantamount to us still paying today on a project that was started before the Great Depression. I mean, that's... So, you know, those things are going to be necessary, and, you know, there are going to be projects here and there where you're going to want to do those, and some areas will do them more than others, because a lot of this will be a balance between how state and local governments want to come up with their portion of this. And some will rely more on the private sector than others, and, you know, there'll be a mix. But we didn't focus a great deal on coming up with a federal mechanism to make it more attractive for them.
Ms. Connolly?
Mr. Shendorf, thank you very much for your presentation, as well as the welling up from the grassroots support for your very good program. I think you also need national leadership.
Right.
And I just, 2 hours ago, had the opportunity of hearing Larry Sabato, our forecaster, almost assuring the audience of many Republicans that we would have almost for certain a solid Senate and a solid House and also the presidency in 2009. Does that give you any optimism in that? Do you know that you already have some friends who are supportive of this approach already embedded in the key committees and perhaps in the Democratic program, or is that kind of unknown?
Well, I mean, we certainly, Congressman Oberstar is chairman of the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee. He's was a staffer on the committee. I mean, he's spent 40, 50 years on the Transportation Committee and is dedicated to transportation, and he's calling for transformation, so we know we have a leader there. On the Senate side, you've got Senator Boxer, and this will really be her first big highway bill, and she has a lot of interest in that committee, so where she comes out in this, how much of her own time and devotion and political capital she uses on this remains to be seen. But you know, certainly, I think in California, they realize the transportation problems that exist. I guess the plea that I would make is that this needs to be bipartisan. I mean, I grew up on a committee where it was there aren't any Democratic roads or Republican bridges. There are American roads and American bridges. And this problem can't be solved if people are sniping and using, you know, tax increase as, you know, a partisan issue. We have to develop a program here that people are willing to pay for and that both parties can get behind, so that there isn't this kind of partisan bickering. If there is, it's not going to happen, because, you know, the majorities aren't going to be sufficient in order to be able to withstand it if it becomes an extremely partisan issue. So I think what we've been trying to do is to basically say we've got to convince everybody that it's in the best interest of this nation to do this. This is a national priority, and then we all need to work together to figure out how to pay for it. I mean, it was a very conservative Republican president that basically tripled the gas tax to pay for the interstate system, and the last increase passed on a voice vote. Can you imagine any tax increase passing on a voice vote in today's Congress? And so, at least in this area, I think the goal would be to depoliticize things and to do what's the best for the country and put the country ahead of the parties, hopefully.
Ms. Carvin.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shenandoah, thank you so much for being here. I listened on your vision and educating the public. And that's what Virginia is certainly in the process of trying to do. And our governor, Governor Kane, is doing a tremendous job with this. And I applaud him for going from different areas. Now, in the national areas to educate the public, do you all have a vision or do you have a plan on how you're going to do this?
Right now, the commissioners are traveling fast like this. I mean, the commissioners are going to try to get out there and do this. There are a number of groups. Governor Rendell, Governor Schwarzenegger are getting together with a group that's being underwritten by the Rockefeller Foundation. There are a number of other entities that are being created to try to increase the awareness of infrastructure. The Chamber of Commerce is got a big program going, and they really have come front and center on the tax issue and said, you know, we're against increasing taxes, but this is a user fee, the users are paying for this, and we've got to do this for our country. So I think a lot of things like that are changing, and hopefully, I mean, the commission plans on making presentation to the platform committees once we have a candidate on the Democratic side, and Governor and Senator McCain is the official Republican nominee, to make presentations to them to see if we can't get the presidential candidates interested in coming out of this. There has been some discussion of it. Senator Clinton, Senator Obama have mentioned infrastructure investment, but it's an uphill battle because this isn't the top of the list of polling. But all the things at the top of the list won't happen if you don't have a first-rate transportation system.
That's right.
Because it'll drag the economy down with it. And when you drag the economy down, you can't do any of those things.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you,
McCarthy, then Mr. Dickens, Mr. Schwartz, and then we're going to have to move on. Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you very much for your report to us and for producing what sounds like a very thoughtful, comprehensive review of the situation. Having recently become a grandparent, I can relate now for the first time in my life to the notion of, you know, doing for our grandchildren what our grandparents did for us. And I take that very seriously. In Virginia, once upon a time, we were a pay-as-you-go state completely. Debt was anathema to us. And some of these projects you alluded to are going to be paid for past the time of my granddaughter's lifespan, still paying for them. I don't consider that to be a fair representation of what our grandparents did for us and what we might do for our grandchildren. So I hope we can have a discussion here at CTV over the coming months, once we get past the special session and see where we are, and figure out how we do make a transportation system in this state and in this country that is all the things that their commission talks about, in fact, because I'm really scared at some of the directions we're going in and leaving a legacy that our grandchildren will curse us for, as they have their own grandchildren at the rate we're going. We have got to do better than that, in my view, and I hope we'll all get a chance to talk about what kind of a system we envision and how it ought to be paid for. And I'll stop right there because there's a lot more that we all need to talk about, and I hope we will.
I think what we found was that there was no one solution that worked. I mean, the idea of doing this all on a pay-as-you-go basis isn't going to work. The idea that you do it all through the private sector, you do it all through debt financing, isn't going to work. And it really needs to be a blend of all of these techniques. The real issue is, as a nation, can we do it smart? Can we make the right decisions so that we're using debt financing where it's appropriate and not unduly burdening future generations and doing a lot of it to pay as you go so that the financing of transportation doesn't become a burden on the economy and a burden on people's way of life? And that's not easy, but that's the goal.
If I might just say, to quote the great Winston Churchill, Mr. Chairman, who said in the darkest days of World War II, we're out of money. It's time to think.
Mr. Dickens, think for us.
I agree with what Stuart says. Our development patterns have scattered to a point in large part as a result of the interstate system and the ability to live a long ways away from where we work and where we live. And we've generated a transportation system that in today's environment, and particularly with the gas prices going where they are, it's, I'm afraid, not going to be sustainable. And my question to you, sir, is if you were sitting where we are, what steps would you take to look at the paradigm, the transportation paradigm in Virginia, and what we need to do as a body to recognize the problems that we have and to develop solutions and changes in our method of operation to accommodate those changes.
I guess I'd make three recommendations. One would be to really talk amongst yourselves, but to talk to all of the important people in Virginia and the citizens of Virginia. If we don't educate people on these issues and what's at stake and what it means for our economy and what the difficult choices are that they have to make, there's no chance of making this become a reality. So you've got to educate that way. I think you've also got to deal with Congress and members of Congress and the new administration and hold them to a high standard. This is a national problem we have, and we had better come up with a national solution, and it's time for some people to come forward and show leadership the way all of those people I talked about before did, and take this on and basically hold them accountable. You know, say we've got to solve this problem, and then, you know, and again, not making it partisan. This has got to be a nonpartisan, bipartisan effort if it's going to become a reality. So those are two things, both people in Virginia and then holding your federal officials accountable. But the other thing is to look more toward the performance-based, to look more toward the performance aspects of this, of having a performance out there. How do we want our transportation system to work? And then what do we have to do to make it work that way? And things look a lot different when you're looking at it through that prism than if you're just looking at, oh, yeah, let's curb, you know, let's clamp down on land use here. And people say, why? And, you know, nobody else is doing anything. You know, why do we have to do something? Well, you're looking at Project A, and, you know, which is a transit project, and the highway people are screaming, you know, why isn't that money going into a highway in rural Virginia? Why is it going into a transit system in northern Virginia? It's because they can't see the linkages now. They can't see how the system works together. And that was one of the eye-opening things in the commission as you looked in these studies. I mean, we have people like Steve Odlin, who was the head of Office Depot, saying, Lori, you can get all your products from all over the country to these metropolitan areas, but if I can't get my trucks out delivering this stuff in the metropolitan areas and my people can't get to and from work, what good is it? And so the metropolitan mobility is actually a very important component of making a national system work, because without that, it chokes off the economic activity in those areas, and if you do that, then everything suffers. And so, again, it gets back to this is one national system that's operated at different levels and everybody has an involvement in. But as we gravitated toward performance standards and we looked at it through that prism, then that helped a lot of the decision-making, because you could see where it would affect land use, where you would get a balance of investment in highways and transit, but they would all be working together and designed to work together to meet the performance standard. And without that linkage, it's hard. I mean, look at your thing on the project out in Dulles. I mean, that was crazy. That thing should have been approved. That shouldn't be a question mark around that. And if it was part of a much bigger plan that people really had confidence in, now people don't have confidence in the plans that are done because they're just piecemeal plans. They're not solving a real transportation problem. And some of what we recommended is going to be extraordinarily difficult and controversial. The State of Good Repair Program, I can't tell you how many states we went to when we asked them about the Woodrow Wilson Bridge, the mixing bowl kinds of projects where you've got to reconstruct the existing interstate, their answer is, we don't talk about those. They're out there. We're scared stiff of them. But we don't ever identify them. We don't write them down, because if we did, people would ask us what we're doing about it. And we don't have a plan on how to deal with it, and so they don't talk about it. The State of Good Repair Program would force people to identify over the next 50 years what are the segments of interstate that are going to have to be rebuilt, what are the segments of interstate that we're going to just, you know, maintain and don't have to be rebuilt, and all of the other infrastructure, our transit infrastructure as well. And that is an enormous, that's half of the costs that we identified here are in those projects that today aren't even being talked about because transportation officials, I'm sure not in the state of Virginia, but the other 49 states, refuse to talk about these projects because if they did, they really would have to identify what needs to be done.
Okay. Mr. Schwartz, the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned fixing project delivery as one of the goals. When we talk about this huge accruing liability, another part of the problem is the cost of doing business, particularly when the federal government's involved. Right. If I had to build my office buildings the way the federal government, or frankly any government, procures, it would cost me $1,000 a square foot and I'd be out of business. A lot of those rules were put in place over a long period of time for the right reasons, to get rid of abuses that had to be addressed. But the fact of the matter is, from my perspective as a private sector executive, that system is so burdensome and so broken that it's adding a huge increment to the cost of doing transportation business. And I'm wondering whether your commission looked at that and whether you've thought about the idea of putting together a panel of people like the executive from Home Depot and other private sector companies who have to address procurement in the context of a relatively large organization, but are still doing it effectively or doing the things necessary to avoid cronyism and preferences and so forth, but without the burdens that are doubling and tripling their costs.
We did look at that. One of the commissioners, Tom Skanke, who's a consultant from Nevada, this was his issue from day one when the commission got started, and we heard about it every meeting. And he was right. I mean, he is right. And so we paid a lot of attention to that issue. I would encourage you to read that part of our report. I think you'll find much of what you're saying here we have acknowledged. And we came up with a very aggressive set of recommendations for how to reform it. Okay. Program. I mean, he sees buildings being built in Las Vegas in 2 years and watches a federal highway project take 15 years. And you know, it doesn't compute. And their transportation is always lagging behind what the private sector is able to do in building in Las Vegas. So he knew what the problems were, and I think we have a good set of solutions. Maybe there's more that we need to do, but I encourage you to take a look at that.
Where can we access your full commission report?
It's www.transportation.
We'll get copies and links tomorrow, and after the CTB.
Okay, that would be great. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it's much better to get a hard copy because these are all in PDF files. It takes forever to download it, but it's transportationfortomorrow.org.
Thank you.
Ms. Shenandoah, I do have one request of you.
Sure.
This slide here, which shows the
right
increasing deficit of the Federal Highway Trust Fund. Is that from the committee report?
This is
on slide 14.
This is from, I believe, a DOT. I've seen this before in many contexts. This is a balance, either CBO or OMB or FHWA's estimates of the balances in the trust fund under the existing levels of funding and the existing revenue streams.
I have a fairly parochial request of you, but okay. There are some who assert that simply the bounce in federal revenues will take care of our transportation needs in Virginia. I wonder if you would be so kind as to simply write me a letter with this slide and explaining where it came from. I think those two pieces of paper are very, very
powerful.
What
was the question that people say that what?
There are folks who are asserting that there will be a natural increase in federal transportation spending that will be available to Virginia and be available to solve our transportation funding problems that we're discussing.
Out of the existing?
Yes, sir.
Not at the existing rates of taxation. That's not true. It'll be a reduction from safe TLU levels and a significant reduction from safe TLU levels.
It would be very helpful if you could just write a very
okay.
short letter and that would say, based on sources, whether it's CBO or DOT, at existing levels of taxation, the next reauthorization bill is probably looking at a 20% to 30% reduction in funding sources or whatever the appropriate
yeah,
estimate
no, I mean,
is.
I think that's what I don't believe that Congress will do that. I mean, I think Congress will find additional revenues to put into the trust fund by raising taxes. But I guess the commission's point would be that that's not enough. I mean, that's a Band-Aid, and it's a poor Band-Aid at that. We have a huge investment gap, and every year we're falling further and further behind. We're digging a deeper and deeper hole, and at some point we won't be able to climb out of that hole.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you can stay to listen. There's a couple of additional presentations I think you'll find very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Shenandoah.
Well done.
The next item on the agenda, item number two, is something we've been waiting for many years. And at your place, you have a letter addressed to Mr. Jim Bennett, who is the executive CEO of the Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority with respect to Dulles Rail. Barbara Reese is going to give us a quick walkthrough of that. You've all read and heard about this. Welcome, Ms. Reese.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I'm just going to hit the highlights of the letter. It was with great relief that on Monday we actually received the hard copy, and with the words written in the first paragraph.
Speak a little loud. The microphone. I must be deaf today because I'm really having a hard time hearing.
No, I had a hard time from where I was sitting too. On Monday we received the official letter that said final design approval, something that many of you in this room have been working on for years and years. We actually submitted the request for final design approval, I think, if Matt would tell me, I think it was last fall.
It was June 2006.
June of 2006, so it only took almost 2 years to get that approval. I would like to point out two members of the CTD who aren't here that used to be former members who were just instrumental in helping the process. But not just the process when I took on this role so the Secretary could focus on the General Assembly back in February. They provided great advice and wisdom to me, and that's Kate Hanley and Kenny Kling, both just tremendous individuals who have been with the project for many, many years. I'm just going to highlight a couple things in the letter so that you can to sort of talk to you about next steps. Next Monday morning, Corey Hill and I will be in Washington to meet with Administrator Simpson and his staff, along with Jim Bennett and John Cato from the Metro, to talk about the next steps and how this process does move forward. On page two of the letter, cost effectiveness, which, without going into all the details about that, that is a mathematical calculation, and there's some qualitative data that goes into that. Every project that wants to qualify for New Start's federal funding must continue to meet. That is an ongoing commitment that the project has, and until we have the last step of the process is what's known as a full funding grant agreement. That's the next step that we're working toward. We have to maintain cost effectiveness of the project until we have a full funding grant agreement. That will be the last time that's really measured. So we will be updating all that information this summer. There were two things in the middle paragraph in page two that we had submitted as cost reductions for the project that were not accepted by FTA that have some critical nature to them. But this sort of shows you the, sort of going back to what Mr. Shendorf said about the bureaucracy of the process. Willie Avenue Parking Garage is a parking garage along the Dulles Toll Road that Fairfax County is actually working with a solicited private development bids for the construction of it. They receive four. It's all going to be privately financed. They see that as part of their transit-oriented development they want to do, but the cost of building that will be part of the cost of the Dulles Rail project, even though there will not be public funding that is part of it. But that's just the way the process is set up and the bureaucracy of the process. Secondly, another example of that is the procurement of rail cars for the entire Dulles project, which will extend out to Loudoun County. In total, I believe the number is 164 rail cars that will have to be purchased. And one of the requests that we had made is could we allocate the cost of the design and procurement administration of that for both phases over the two phases of the project and not just one. And that was another thing that could not meet the requirements of the process. So those are just some of the examples. They have costs that build up. Those two items between them are close to $70 million. We did achieve cost effectiveness at $29.25. I believe our cap was a little bit over $30, so we came in right under the wire. On page three, and this again goes back to what Mr. Schendorf mentioned, state of good repair is probably one of the two items that I spent the most time on over the last 60 to 90 days. And this is about our existing metro system here in the Washington, D.C. region. It's 32 years old. It's aging, just like our interstates, just like our bridges, just like our secondary system. And there is concern at both the federal, local, and state level, as well as the regional level, about maintaining that system in good repair, just as when Commissioner Eckern came into VDOT and as Matt came in to the Department of Rail and Public Transportation. John Cato is new to the Metro General Manager role, and he's seen things that he feels like are compelling needs that need to be addressed without sufficient funding to address those. So Governor Kane, part of the conversations we have, Governor Kane had already been talking with the Metro Board based on the Secretary's recommendation about convening a summit sometime later this year to talk about those issues with Metro. Metro funding is not just a Virginia funding, it's also Maryland and Washington, D.C. So Governor Kane has sent a letter to the Governor of Maryland and Mayor Fenty requesting that we work very closely together with the Metro Board to identify what is needed to maintain a state of good repair, not just financially, but equipment-wise and whatnot, and plans are that we would convene a summit of that group along with our federal counterparts and local representatives sometime late in the fall. On page four, there are a couple. This is where you start to see some of the other requirements that the project will have to meet and what organization will have to do to move the project into a full funding grant agreement. We are targeting right now very tentatively that we would try to submit for a full funding grant agreement in the August-September time frame. The first requirement is there's a number of staff that need to be hired by the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, by the contractor, by a number of different groups that are involved in the project. One of the things on working on that, we would go out and they would try to advertise and recruit people in and to get the best and the brightest of the crop. They want to know the project was moving forward. So we were caught in this horrible catch-22 of where you would identify incredibly competent staff that you want to bring to the project, but because incredibly competent staff sometimes can be few and far between, they have multiple offers, and they're not going to come to a project that they don't know they have a long-term job for when you have to move your family and whatnot. So now we hope that that issue will go away with final design approval. The second thing that is a requirement, we had actually discussed it with the FTA probably about a year ago, and it is the establishment of a capital reserve account of up to $200 million. And there's a number of ways that that account will be funded. We don't have to identify that today, how we'll put the funding into it, but that is something that they're requesting. That will be on top of about a 16% contingency budget for the project, but this is just additional assurances. If something would happen and the costs go up, there would be a place for the money to come from instead of it having to compete with other projects. On page five, the certificate of compliance, the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority operates the Dulles Access Road under a certificate from the Federal Aviation Administration, from USDOT, and there had been a request just to acknowledge the fact that the operating and maintaining the Dulles Toll Road fit within the purpose of that certificate. And there's been back and forth about that probably for about the last year or so. That certificate is being issued. That was the last step for the Dulles Toll Road to be transferred to the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, and we are targeting a July 1st date to start that transition. The reason that's important is the Dulles Toll Road, as you know, this board dedicated 85% of the excess toll revenue from that facility to transit into the Dulles Rail Project, and that allows them to then bond against that revenue for the project. On page five, the conditions for consideration of a full funding grant agreement, most of those, other than the capital reserve account, are things that are required of every project. And a lot of the new project, larger projects, also have a capital reserve account. The financial plan has to be updated. The technical requirements have to be updated. There has to be a maintenance of an overall project rating of medium. The only other thing I would note there is in technical capacity, WMATA and the Metro and the Washington, Metropolitan Washington Air Force Authority are planning to do a joint recruitment for an executive project director. Because MWA, the Airport Authority, is constructing the project, but Metro will operate the project, both felt that they needed to do a joint effort to hire the person who would lead the project to make sure that both aspects of the project would be considered and dealt with in an appropriate manner, and that recruitment is actually underway as well. Lastly, on page 6 are two things I just want to point out. One of the things about project readiness and project management planning that we've spent a lot of time discussing over the last few months is the fact that there's lots of great words put down on paper and all these documents that have had to be submitted to FTA, but we need to make sure that the words are alive and that there are actions that demonstrate that we're living to the spirit and the letter of those words. And so that is a renewed focus by all the partners to make sure that everybody's talking together. Matt, for example, is the one who's dealing with all the contract and technical issues and making sure that everybody understands each other's perspective so that we can move the project forward. And then lastly, final design approval did release the remaining about $157, $159 million in federal funds that had already been appropriated to the project, but they were simply being held by FTA, and now they have been released for spending. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. It's been an educational process the last few months, I'll say that.
Questions of Ms. Reese?
Secretary Reese, thank you very much for the brief, but also for your efforts. I mentioned to you before the meeting, among others, not just the Washington Post, Congressman Frankel just said quietly to me, this wouldn't have happened without you. So thank you very much for your individual commitment. Thank you, Mr. Secretary, for having the great sense to send her up here until it was done. I have a question about the cost reductions.
Mm-hmm.
Are any of these things considered essential to the project that you put back in, or is this simply a difference in methodology to evaluate what the true savings would be for them?
Last fall, we were asked to come up with a listing of cost reductions, and I believe the list we submitted to FTA was about $300 million. And this was a joint list of reductions that were identified by all the funding partners. There's nothing that is detrimental to the project. We don't remove a station at this point. We don't do any of those things. And so these were just what they accepted of the list that was submitted.
Second question is on the risks and uncertainties. Some of the words in the letter make them sound very risky and very uncertain, but these appear to me to be fairly normal risks and uncertainties that are associated with any complex project. Is that your view, Katie?
Yes, I would say that just like the Woodrow Wilson Bridge project and just like the Springfield project and just like the Hot Lanes project and the Mercury Boulevard project down in Hampton Roads, all these projects that are large projects have risk associated with them. I think the risk here is you do have one builder, one entity building a project from a construction viewpoint, and another one that will have to operate it. So making sure that that group of individuals talks and communicates well and all those things are seamlessly integrated is critical. But I think we put in place a great plan and approach to how to deal with that. So it is just a complex transportation world today.
Final comment, Mr. Chairman. This truly is a critical project for Northern Virginia. It's sparking the type of cooperation and collaboration locally among jurisdictions, among different governmental entities, with the private sector and so forth, that really begin to show what that larger vision of the Transportation Commission was talking about. It also, this decision has had a major effect on, let's call it, regional morale here. The public overwhelmingly has supported this project from the beginning, and yet it's taken almost two decades. It's been difficult to keep the consensus alive and going from time to time. But this is really a signal that there is a way that we can plan, that we can envision, that we can follow through, we can make something happen And it's a good lesson for our region. It's a good lesson, I think, for the Commonwealth as well. So thank you very much for your most recent.
Thank you. I would be remiss if I didn't point out the secretary, too, who has spent tireless hours on this project for years. And I can tell you it makes it easy to walk in and try to pick up some pieces and keep the ball moving. But you're right. I mean, Fairfax County, Loudoun County's leadership, everybody's leadership. When, you know, when January, the end of January happened, everybody called and said, okay, tell me what I can do to help. And everybody was willing to listen and talk to each other and figure out ways to move it forward. And you don't usually see that. As I told you earlier, I thought my job was just herding the cats. And making sure everybody was talking to each other. But it is amazing to watch what you can accomplish in a very short period of time, really, if everybody just talks and cooperates. So with that,
I would tend to underscore what has just been said. As devastatingly horrible as that January morning was, I think the project has come out, I don't know, stronger, but certainly the unity and the regional support has been invigorated, because they really, I mean, it was serious. I think we thought we were going to lose it. And you saw all kinds of groups that may have been lukewarm, but suddenly all coming to the fore, and different little, disagreements of various sorts were resolved. And again, thank the secretary and Barbara for just putting so much energy and diligence and also a lot of intelligence into this.
Well, and Governor Kane, I know the secretary would say the same thing. The personal attention he's given to this project is amazing to me, and he's as knowledgeable about it as anybody. So he really had a personal commitment to see it through, and it was with great pleasure that I handed him the letter on Monday. I can tell you that. So,
Jim, what date can we expect for sort of the final agreement, do you think?
We are shooting for a full funding grant agreement to be submitted, like I said, in the August-September time frame. And Administrator Simpson, the day that the 10-day calendar clock started, said that they really would like to see construction underway before they leave office, which would be December. So we will work diligently to try to give them that, which they said they'd like to see.
Okay. There's a couple of things. I would just mention, again, the direct conversation between the governor and Secretary Peters, and that personal common sense relationship is so important to solving problems. And for those folks from outside the Northern Virginia District, I would say a couple of things, that this project is part of a very long-standing regional vision. We may not see it here at the CTV, but with 20 years and some would say 30 years of planning, it's to get transportation choices in each of the radial corridors. So that's not just highways, but HOV, bus, and rail, in some cases two rail options in those corridors, to have an interconnected HOV network. That's what the Beltway Hot Lanes is all about, is to connect the hot lanes among those corridors. This has been thought out. There is a very clear vision. There has been one in this region for many decades. It has simply been, in some instances, not even a lack of funding, just institutional barriers. And so this breakthrough, again, through the consensus between the governor and Secretary Peters, was really in recognition of that vision. So that's the first thing I would say. The second is that, as the governor has said, the only person who will certainly lose is he or she who backs away from the table. And if we never give up, we will never lose. And so there's a very important and valuable lesson there for us. The third thing is that this decision by the Federal Transit Administration creates a lot of additional work for this body. And so one of the things, there were several questions about land use. Again, that has been thought about in great detail, embodied in the governor's amendments last year. House Bill 3202 is a requirement for land use and performance measures for this region and Hampton Roads. This is part of it. And there is a group known as the Tyson's Land Use Task Force. I believe that Mr. Coulombe was at one point the chair of that, still sits on that body. But
this project is accompanied by a very significant increase in residential and commercial densities. And so I will ask at the appropriate time when our schedule permits for Mr. Tyler and Mr. Coulombe to come and make a presentation to us. I think it's appropriate that they need to conclude their work first, probably in a June-July time frame. But perhaps in the fall we'd be in a position to look at and see in this quarter how transportation and land use are being integrated and what that means and the difficulty of those choices. It's very easy to talk about integrating transportation and land use in the abstract. In reality, it is very, very difficult, very confrontational, and very expensive. And I think there's will be some valuable lessons for that. The other thing is that Ms. Reese mentioned the transition of the Dulles Toll Road to the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. That clock will start, all things, assuming there are no unexpected occurrences, this July. And again, I'd like to find some time, hopefully this fall, to have a joint meeting of the Airports Authority and the Commonwealth Transportation Board in advance of the final transition. Now, that will take place over a number of months. But that's a very, very important facility, which is today. This body controls the rate setting on there. VDOT administers that, and that's a transition of a very important function. And I think that kind of convergence of the two governing entities will be very important in that transition process. Last, I would like to simply echo something that Barbara Reese talked about at the outset, which is, a major project like this is a little bit like a relay race, and you think Mr. Coulombe's predecessors in that chair, Kenny Kling started it, Kate Hanley picked up the baton, but we gave the anchor leg to Barbara Reese. And thank you, Barbara, for your very hard work. And we also have to thank our track coach, Governor Kane. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, with the transfer, does all responsibility for decisions related to the toll road go from this body then to MWA?
Yes, sir.
At a certain date certain?
Mm-hmm. And that actual date certain, that's the rate setting, and that will be spelled out in the final agreement. There's a clock associated with that, and so we'll be able to lay out that period when we get to that transition.
Right. That's what I understood, that a lot of the process and the rulemaking and so forth stays the same, just which authorities make for making the final decision.
Yes, sir. The next item on the agenda is a new addition. I thought it would be helpful for me to run quickly through the governor's transportation funding proposal, and mostly to give you all, you've had a chance to read it, to ask any questions so you can be well-armed as you go out into your communities. The governor's program, if you've had an opportunity to look at it, does have the three components. The first and foremost, as we know from our work here, is safety first, the proper maintenance and operation of our highway system. Just look at what it takes to evacuate Hampton Roads now more than 24 hours, and with climate change and rising sea level, that is an increasingly serious issue. As Mr. Shenendorf talked to us about, the greatest generation gave us the interstate highway system, which turned 50 last year, and simply maintaining and taking care of that is commanding an ever larger amount of our resources. We're all familiar this year, as we've done for the last several years, we take money out of our construction program and put it into highway maintenance to meet our needs. This bar chart in red illustrates the amount of money that is coming out of construction each year and put into maintenance. That's what we call the maintenance deficit. And in the current fiscal year, it's about $260 million. By the end of our six-year planning horizon, FY14, that rises to $575 million.
And to put that in perspective, we spend about $220, $230 million statewide on secondary and urban construction. That's a very significant amount. The blue bars represent the Kane plan and a surplus. We don't need big numbers for maintenance. We need to meet our needs by doing a couple of things on the funding front that I'll talk about in just a minute. But essentially, it involves a dedication to the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund of a 1% increase of the motor vehicle sales and use tax, which is currently 3%, going up to 4%. And remember, our statewide sales tax is 5%, so this is still below the level other commodities are taxed. It also involves a $10 increase in the annual vehicle registration fee, going from $39.50 to $49.50. And lastly, there's a complex transaction that would move an existing 1% sales tax on automobile sales and moving that out of the construction accounts and into maintenance. It's a truth in budgeting. Effectively, we are doing that today with some of these transfers. Okay? The second component of the governor's transportation proposal is to meet the minimal threshold needs identified by the two regions through the imposition of a regional 1% sales tax. The Northern Virginia package will generate in the early years a little over $300 million a year and then escalate very quickly to about $400 million a year in Northern Virginia just with the sales tax. The combined benefit of these two sources, the regional 1% and the elimination of the maintenance deficit and the creation of a new funding source I'll talk about at the end called the Transportation Change Fund, would essentially double transportation investments in Northern Virginia from about $500 million a year on average to about $1 billion a year on average. It's a very, very significant sum of money, heavily oriented towards rail, transit, and the maintenance and operation of the existing highway system. In Hampton Roads, you see similar percentages, although on a similar base. And in Hampton Roads, once again, the 1% regional sales tax there generates about $200 million a year and escalates a little more slowly than it does in Northern Virginia. That 1% sales tax plus the statewide package allow the annual investments in transportation in Hampton Roads to increase on average from about $200 million a year to about $450 million a year on average. And again, for that region, a very substantial increase. Much of these additional funds are dedicated towards the 7 regional projects in Hampton Roads that have been around, a subject to referendum, last year's legislation, plus the addition of the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, that would be a new 7th project for inclusion in their regional package. Cumulative effect of the statewide pieces are illustrated here. The red bar, think about this, the escalating gray is what it will cost us over the next 15 years or so to maintain our existing system of highways. And that is a steady upward march. It is inexorable, and I will say, given recent escalation in every commodity associated with highway maintenance, these are probably very conservative numbers. What that does is every penny, as you know, that goes into maintenance comes out of highway construction. So you see a shrinking highway construction account. What is most important to look on this chart is the rapid decline of red, where a legislator asked me the question, well, why is that not proportional? Because beginning in 2016, because of our requirement to meet our maintenance needs, we are no longer able to fully match federal dollars. And you see the highway construction accounts really between FY16 and 19 and probably by fiscal year 21-22 on this track reduced to zero. The 2016 is a very, very serious date, and the 6-year program that you all look at next year we'll start to take account of the inability to match federal dollars. The last item of the governor's proposal is something he is calling the Transportation Change Fund. This is funded through a dedication of a statewide grantor's tax. That is something 25 cents per $100 of value that is assessed on every housing sale. Does not apply to refinancings or deeds of trust, things of that nature. And it is focused on transit, on rail, on economic development, on ports and airports. And for example, it's about $150 million a year, about two-thirds of it going to transit, another 10% going to rail. You can see on top of last year's investments with the dedication of the recordation tax at the state level, the creation of the Rail Enhancement Fund in 2005, look where we were back in fiscal year 1998, 10 years ago, about $50 million in rail and transit investments. Today, we're about $250 million, and with these additions, we'll be well in excess of $350 million on an annual basis. That's a very significant addition. Now, a big part of this is also to provide a fund for economic development initiatives. And probably every one of you in your district has been to one of these economic development announcements, whether it was Cannon in the Hampton Roads area or Rolls-Royce just outside of Tidewater, the Orbital Sciences project up in Loudoun County, the Swedewood IKEA proposal in Danville. The list goes on and on. There is not a major economic prospect that is not dependent on road or rail or air access. And so a portion of this Transportation Change Fund is not just thinking about we've got a changing energy environment, so we need more transit, we need more rail, but it's also about, and I think very instructive, Mr. Shenendorf's met, where he talks about concentrated economic development. We have got at the state level to worry about a series of haves and have-nots and keeping those parts of the Commonwealth connected to the economic mainstream is so very, very important and a big part of the governor's transportation package. That's a quick overview. Just in terms of simplicity, House Bill 3202 had 15 separate revenue sources. Governor Kaine's proposal has four. Okay? And they're very simple. 1% sales tax imposed regionally by the Commonwealth, a 1% increase when you buy a new or a used car, a $10 annual registration fee for when you renew your annual registration, and a 25 cent per hundred fee if you are selling your home. Not if you're buying, but only if you're selling. And so if you stand back and look at that package outside of the urbanized areas, you would only pay $10 a year unless you were selling your house or buying a new car. Inside the urbanized areas, there are very specific projects that you can see benefit from as well as the cost. And for those areas where Hampton Roads with a strong tourism base, Northern Virginia with a number of hotels and people who come in and use those, that is a significant way to be able to capture some out-of-state revenues, which are an important part of the funding puzzle. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. White.
Mr. Chairman, obviously the governor is to be commended for the leadership he's shown with this package, and you and others have worked hard on it, and you're to be commended as well. My question is, where will we be if we assume this whole package is enacted? Where will we be compared to where we thought we were with 3202 before it started coming apart?
Tonight is actually a perfect night. I've got a series of boards back there by district, and I may pull them out when we take a little bit of a break. If you've seen the charts for your district, there are red light, yellow light, green light. And each one of those charts shows, by virtue of the economic downturn and the loss of the House Bill 3202 revenues, projects that were in the six-year plan that are just being canceled show up as red. If they're being delayed, they show up as yellow. If they're going ahead as previously scheduled, they're green. Every district is mostly red and yellow.
We have recalculated with Governor Kane's program what the difference would be, and it's rather stark. In most of the districts outside, and Northern Virginia is always a slightly different case, you'll see probably 90% of those red and yellow lights going green. And we do have a project list associated with that. So, and that will be part of the public hearing and town hall process underway. We think it's very important to link additional money. Here's what you get for that. And maybe what we can do is set some of these up so you can see what that format is. And
that'd be
probably
good.
Those of you who are interested in the project designation, spend time with your district administrators to answer those questions.
Dr. Davis.
Yes, you and the governor have my compliments for the package you've put together. I look at it as a bit of the art of the possible, because it appears to have the focus where there's reasonable support that it might can happen. But I'm sad that it's not possible with the attitude of a lot of the legislators that are in the region that I serve, being opposed to any increase, that we're not approaching the question of allowing the through traffic to pay any part of the cost of our improvements under any of these scenarios. It's a strictly Virginia Pays solution. And I wish that the art of possible would include working with those legislators in some way to help educate them to the fact that we have to approach that issue, and the only way we can approach the issue is with, I believe, either tolls or the gas tax. And the I-81 corridor, I know you sat through the hearings the other day in my district, and the people know that improvements have to be made in order to protect the economy of the valley, and also in order to protect the environment and the beauty of the valley. And without any source in any of these discussions to really seriously help deal with that issue, I see us putting off 5 or 10 years addressing any serious improvements to 81. And I just wish maybe that the legislature itself would step up to the plate on that one and say, we can't just have an urban solution to Virginia's transportation needs. We really need to look at that corridor in a really serious fashion. And I wish, and I'll do everything I can to try to help encourage that while complimenting the governor and you and others for what you've put together.
Thank you. The governor wrestled long and hard. The issue is the gas tax, and it is an excellent user fee. There's no question about it. But the recent and dramatic spike in prices, that's the kind of decision that a governor gets paid to make, and he made that decision and correctly. But the issue of how to get a fair apportionment of costs, and as you know, Mr. Shenandoah talked about, you know, these problems don't stop at the state line. So whether it's a gas tax or a VMT tax, we have to find something that is more. And to me, it's so very interesting. We're wrestling with the exact same set of issues internal to Virginia that your commission was, of, you know, these mega regions versus the rest of the country. It's a very, very challenging, very difficult issue, particularly when you look at the impact on aviation, the lack of rail alternatives. What's going to happen when commercial airports in the less populated regions simply discontinue service? Lynchburg itself has been on and off in terms of commercial air service the last couple of years. Danville has no commercial air service. And so what happens when those communities are unable to connect affordably to the economic mainstream? That's a very live, very real question, and very important that as we think about transportation, it's not just, you know, moving boxes or people. It is connecting communities to the global economy. And if you're not connected, you're not connected.
Mr. Bowie.
Do I correctly understand that the governor's program would exempt food and over-the-counter medicines from the regional sales tax?
Yes, sir. That's correct. The regional sales tax only applies to discretionary consumer purchases. It does not apply to food or non-prescription drugs.
Mr. Coulomb.
Mr. Secretary, thank you again from this body. We have talked about the need for additional resources in the system, and certainly this is a bold initiative by the governor that would have a significant impact. If it can be
approved. I would like to say from our own region's perspective, even though there may be some continued discussion about the specifics, that the strength of the governor's plan is it's very businesslike, it sizes the problem, and it designs a solution that meets that size. And quite frankly, that's what our region has been looking for a long time, is honesty in the assessment of need and honesty in the design of a solution that's dedicated, that's sustainable, that grows with as the need grows, so that we're not back in the soup in a very short period of time. I would point out that the ability to double the resources for Northern Virginia is also a strength of the plan, and that those bars that the governor has now set, if there are alternatives to be considered, personally, my advice is they have to meet those thresholds. They can't be less if we're really going to tackle this properly. So, again, thank you. Thank you, Governor.
And just to, Ms. Chairman, to remind the body of what those thresholds are, if you're asked what's a credible plan, $200 million a year for Hampton Roads, $300 million a year for Northern Virginia, $400 million a year statewide. It's kind of a simple equation, simple way to remember. Simple test and a simple, easy way to evaluate some of these other proposals that will be coming out. Thank you.
I'll get you, Mr. Keith.
just really a statement. Yeah. In light of the fact that the press reports that some of the leaders in the House have said that the plan's dead on arrival, I think the challenge before them, and we should challenge them to provide really you and the governor empirical evidence that 2016 chart that you just presented doesn't exist. Because if it does, then they're saying to the public in Virginia, we're not planning to maintain any of the roads that we have, and we're not planning to build any more roads. And I think that's the challenge before us, is that we take that to the public. If they got an alternative plan, let's hear it. Otherwise, don't state it as it is. We don't intend to maintain after 2016. Certainly, nothing's available to build. And that's the, I guess, the bipartisan effort we need. That Mr. Shenandoah mentioned just doesn't exist, and particularly in this state now, to take care of our needs, and that's something we've got to work on. And maybe it takes an election or two to get there, but I believe we can.
And I would say 2016 is not only that we're not going to build any more roads. 2016 are gas taxes paid by Virginia residents and citizens that will be exported to other states, and that is an unacceptable alternative.
I think we maybe need a bullet presentation that I'll use in some of the public presentations I'll make to educate the public to that, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Secretary?
You all want to take a quick break? Let's do that. Thank you, everybody, after that brief break. Agenda item number 3 is every bit as important as Dulles Rail, as the long-term infrastructure needs of the federal government, and as important as the governor's proposal to adequately fund transportation infrastructure. It is to properly operate our existing infrastructure, particularly under emergency conditions. And whether it's rising sea levels, climate change, the number of tornadoes this year nationwide is about an eightfold increase already from last year. And so what the commissioner has undertaken following some recent storm events is terribly important, and this is a very important presentation that will affect service delivery by the department for the next several years. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and good afternoon, everybody. What I'm going to report to you today on is the results. Now, if you all recall, on March 20th, I gave you a status report, an interim plan for after action from the February 12th event in Northern Virginia. I promised at that point that we were in the process of developing and will begin to roll out next week the long-term action plan for emergency response within the Commonwealth. Over the last 12 weeks, I have engaged in excess of 300 professionals, both within the department, in other agencies, and in fact, Mordezai and I held a public meeting in Northern Virginia at the end of April to gather public input around this topic. What I'm going to present to you today, and which Carol is handing out, is the formal action plan that I have adopted and that we will be deploying over the next 18 months within the department, focusing on emergency response. I want to give you the highlights of that today, and I want to emphasize as I move into this that in the initiatives that I've been engaged in terms of what our business is about, this has the fundamental potential to make the single biggest impact as we live through the restructuring and reshaping of VDOT around the mission that has been reshaped over the last 70 months. Why have we put this plan together? It's not solely about February 12th. It is about what you see on the left-hand side or right-hand side of this picture, which talks about lane closures and emergencies that have occurred. And if I track, my numbers aren't exactly right, but since October of 06, we have closed major facilities approximately 119 times for in excess of 4.5 hours, with some closures reaching 28 hours in terms of the kinds of crashes that you see here. At the very front end of an emergency is what you see in the lower left corner. You have a flat tire. You're on the side of a road, either in a deserted area or in a high-speed interstate corridor. That's an emergency. It's not a flat tire. It's not about safety service patrol. It's about emergency response, because your life is at risk. So that shows you the spectrum. What types of incidents are we going to focus at? And it really covers that spectrum, but it brings together, and this is a very clear, and I've targeted this initiative very carefully to these types of incidents: weather-related, major and minor crashes, hazardous material spills, and terrorist attacks. At the positive end of that weather-related experience, last Sunday, we did our rehearsal, our second rehearsal, around hurricane evacuation from Hampton Roads on I-64. It was exhilarating, very frankly, to watch five agencies and the National Guard working together to demonstrate lane closure and reopening to make sure that we're prepared. Why do I use that as an example? Because it's the hallmark of where this plan is going to take us across this spectrum of emergency response. The goals of the plan are very clear and very straightforward. We are going to create a department-wide, comprehensive, and coordinated incident response focus. We are going to realign equipment, funding, and protocols to strengthen all stages of incident response or emergency response. We are clearly going to integrate and balance our contract resources together with public resources in terms of snow and ice removal, and we are going to focus at removing barriers that we have put in place ourselves to hinder response. You'll see the central themes in the plan really focus around lessons we have learned about improving communication with the public and the media. I have now read three reports prepared around this incident and around national incidents, which really brings to the forefront how critically our citizens count on the information outlets and media that they need to be able to know where they are and what is happening to them while they're in the middle of it. We're going to implement best practices for incident response statewide. And we could, I could talk to you at length about what that really means internally with the department as you transfer practices from area to area within the department. We'll adopt a national system of principles and procedures. It's called NIMS. It's the National Incident Management System. We have trained extensively on that within the department, but now we're bringing it to real life and true application. We will improve and institutionalize incident response training within the department. I often give speeches about the idea that this is a business you cannot go to school to learn. This is a business that once you've gotten a base degree, you've gotten a base employment, you're obligated to learn how this works, and we're obligated to teach that discipline. And we will improve coordination between other agencies and the private sector involved in incident response. We have a series of disconnects, but the connections have been made because our people are talented and know how to make the connections. We need to be able to move that on to the next generation, and that's all about what this plan does for us. It's a simple plan in that it only contains 13 items. But it does direct an investment over the next 4 to 5 years that could approach somewhere around $300 million. My initial program estimates show that between internal redirection and investments needed in the system, we'll be somewhere around $281.5 million at this point. We have an implementation timeline and focus of 18 months, but that will stretch with deployment of the technologies that we need to deploy to about 4 to 5 years. In other words, you can't build Rome in a single day, or rebuild Rome in a single day, if you will. Let me give you the sense in the next 7 slides very quickly of the focus of the investments and the activities that you will see going on within the department. First, there'll be an investment in full technology deployment and traveler information. We have been on this journey for several years. I intend to plot the course to finish the deployment of what you see listed in this plan. That is a significant investment. It will require refurbishing of a lot of our technology and to put it on a common base so that you don't have different technologies being used in different locations. You have to have the transparency to be able to use this. It's a service to the citizen and it's a service for our employees, very frankly. Second, I use this as a way to bring about a change in the way we view the system. Today we think about our service in terms of geographic areas. Tomorrow we will think about it in terms of systems, veins, arteries, and capillaries. It will fundamentally change our approach to how we reopen and reestablish and focus our resources to do emergency response. It will create an interdependency between our districts and our regions as they provide that emergency response service. I talk to my staff about an 82nd airborne mentality, how to deploy rapidly, how to move equipment, and how to respond to those emergencies in real time. Not for a sustained period, but for that period that gets us back in service. It's a different kind of a mindset. I use the phrase with the staff that this plan is about jurisdictional neutrality and creating a seamless activity. Fundamentally changes the way we think about deploying equipment and people in any given response. Third, we will be, throughout that plan, you'll note a change in our practices. Very clearly from reactive to proactive, being there before the emergency hits. That's what NIMS is all about. It's called an all-hazards approach. That is what the practice of anti-icing versus de-icing is all about. Anti-icing tells you we will be there before the storm to prepare and prevent. Well, de-icing is a reactionary activity. That is a significant change in the way we approach the way we do business today. We will develop a plan of these practices that we do, in fact, use statewide. We will expand the role of our TMCs, and now I apologize to my staff already. In the last 6 months, I've changed the name of our five centers from smart traffic centers to traffic management centers, and as a result of the events this winter, to traffic operations centers. They will truly become those points that when you need command and control structure, when you need decisions made quickly, that is where and where you need to integrate various agencies. We have an asset for which we can now really make positive use. And we will implement what I have coined as the officer of the day command for emergency response. Very simply, very straightforwardly, I need to let people know that that our static organization, if you look at our traditional organization as a department, it is not geared to rapid decision making. One of the lessons we learned is that when you have a freeway crash that shuts down a freeway, people are trying to make decisions using a static organization. That sometimes can take 8 layers to make a decision, not always within VDOT, but across government. At the end of the day, this plan will reduce that decision-making to no more than 3 layers of decision-making. Most decisions will be made by on-scene commanders, and only the most complex and difficult decisions will have to be elevated, and those will be made by what I've labeled as officer of the day. And that's where the decision will get made, and they will implement that decision. You will see a change and a full deployment to ensure that we have interoperability within department staff and across agencies. We are partway there. We will finish that deployment. We will incorporate that with our private sector partners who are a part of our emergency response team during the wintertime. It is tremendous. It is a tremendous asset. It makes the difference, very frankly. And you'll read that across a variety of the input that I got in developing this plan about the ability to communicate within VDOT, within our contracting staff, and across the agencies. You will see us put an emphasis on our equipment, remodeling, renewing, and implementing a new approach around relocating that equipment to where it needs to be based on the season of the year and the type of emergency that is there. One of the things that we have learned and articulated as a part of this plan is that we need to place in strategic and tactical locations emergency response trailers that are ready to go and can be hooked up to and easily deployed for any given emergency. We also know, and I use these pictures very carefully, that the equipment and the technology that our people need in the field will necessarily change the look and fit of what is inside the cab of any given response vehicle. This is kind of exciting, and very frankly, I think will empower our staff tremendously as we move forward. You will also see that we are placing an emphasis on education and training of staff. We will supplement our operator training academies that we have for heavy equipment operation with, for the first time ever, a first line and that officer of the day training academy, the first one which will be held August 17th of this year. where we focus at rapid decision making, the NIMS activities, incident command structures, and all the tools that staff needs as they're making decisions in the field. You do not approach this trivially. You do not approach it and say we can learn about it over time. You can learn about this in the classroom. You can exercise it in the classroom. Tabletop exercise. How do you solve this problem? How do you solve a snow and ice event on top of or with a terrorist potential event on top of it? That really starts to exercise how you will react when you're faced with a situation. I do not want people pulling books off of shelves and starting to look through sheets to say, how am I supposed to deal with this situation? It needs to be this way. And that is where we're headed. Last theme that you'll see that we learned about talking to people across the department is that over time, we have put in place a variety of barriers to prevent all kinds of behaviors. What I heard very clearly from staff across the state was that those barriers or those protections, changes in practice that we put in place, have in fact gotten in the way of rapid response to emergency situations. My staff and I are committed to saying where those were internally imposed rules, we need to revisit that. And we need to remove those barriers so that we can, in fact, serve the customer efficiently and quickly. And that's a real challenge. Now, this plan has not just, you know, I just didn't think this up. As I said when I started, this has engaged well over 300 professionals as well as citizen input. I need to let you know that as we move forward, starting next week with this initiative, that we went through about 14 drafts of that 13 action items that you see there. The Research Council, Gary Allen and Kathy McKee, have done an absolutely masterful job of pulling people together, getting this distilled and getting an understanding as we move forward. The management structure for this program will engage a leadership team. And at this point, we have identified about 23 action teams that will bring clarity to bring the initiatives across the finish line. I've asked specifically two individuals to work with me on this. First, I will lead personally the leadership team. Two, that leadership team will be populated by Ms. Sorrell, key staff, and district administrators, maintenance staff from across the Commonwealth. I have asked, Jimmy, I got to ask you to stand up. Jimmy White, a residency administrator from the Stanton District, Verona residency, and Quentin Elliott, our acting district administrator, to be the day-to-day point people on this activity. Jimmy will take on a special assignment for that, and Quentin. And very frankly, I very carefully selected these two individuals for a variety of reasons. Jimmy, because of his role and experience at the residency level. Quentin, because he brings to the table what I believe to be the best in understanding VDOT operations and a military perspective to this part of our business, which is absolutely critical to its success. And I think those two pieces will help us move forward very rapidly. They have identified individuals for each of the 23 action teams, and we are now populating those. That first leaders meeting is next week, where we'll talk about the specifics of the mission and the accomplishment that we need to have finished by over the next 18 months. I keep bringing this back because it's where this all starts and it's where it all ends. It's around our mission of planning, operating, and maintaining the system for safety and ease of movement of goods and people. This is not an easy task, but I think it can be a very exciting stage for the department and a very energizing stage for our people, the staff within the department, as we move forward, because I think it brings true value to the business that they run and the work that they do. With that, I'll stand for questions, Mr. Secretary.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Secretary.
Commissioner, Ms. Carter.
I'm going to put this in plain terms. Maybe it's because of age, but I am so excited. I just think that this plan is wonderful. And when I hear anti-icing, I know it's age, because I've never heard, in Virginia, I have never heard of that before, and I think it's wonderful. You and your staff have done an excellent job. I'm just real excited about it. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And when I hear of all the accidents on 95, and of course 95 is right over the hill from where I live, and I look and I see all of the traffic backed up, and then I try to get out on Route 1, and I can't get out, and it's just very exciting. So I commend you all to the highest. Thank
you very much,
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Davis.
I'm curious if you've had a chance, since you put this in place, to take a preliminary look at evacuation of the Hampton Roads area, of what the scenario might be.
Thank you, Dr. Davis. This actually is, I participated last weekend in the second evacuation drill that VDEM, State Police, National Guard, our agency puts together, and our contractors, to rehearse how we would do that, utilizing the gates. It was just fun to watch. They have a script this thick, that's about an inch for folks that can't see it, that really works through the details of how are you going to do this. That's what we're talking about statewide for a whole variety of activities we do.
Did it look good?
It was. They actually completed their drill about 20 minutes ahead of schedule from what they had anticipated they would do. But we learned some more things last weekend about what we need to do a little bit differently. Each one of those rehearsals is really critical. That's what we're talking about. Response is what we've relied on. That's what our people are good at. Preparation and thinking ahead is where we have not supported them as we should. So I was pretty excited about what I saw over the weekend.
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, I like your mission statement. I think it captures one of our concerns here, that operations are an ongoing and necessary part of the duties of VDOT, and really we're looking forward to more resources. I have a question. What is the hang-up with the communications equipment interoperability? That's been a problem in Virginia for 20 years. Technologies continue to advance. Are we close to having that happen, or do we still face some real hurdles? What are they?
Even on Sunday, as I watched the drill going on, I watched a combination of two-way radios and cell phones getting used to make the communications happen. In a post 9/11 era where we really understood what interoperability meant, it has probably been the single biggest challenge that our community as an emergency response community has had to face, breaking down the silos of how you get interoperability, because there are a tremendous number of, in my experience base, concerns on the enforcement side about access to networks, access to radios, because of some highly secure information. And we've been viewed as, very frankly, public works agencies, as opposed to emergency responders. It's only over the last 6 or 7 years that we've really been able to bring home the message that what we do is about emergency response. I think we're close. Virginia is well positioned to get it done and get it across the finish line. I can't tell you today what that will cost at the end of the day, but that's where we're headed, and I intend to see that get done in the next 18 months.
What's the biggest constraint that you have
in achieving these goals? Is it the training? Is it the technology? Is it the working through the way the equipment and the other resources are deployed? I mean, what ultimately is the biggest barrier you're trying to get over here? And how can we help with whatever that is?
There's a political answer, and then I'll tell you what we know about the industry I work in. And I don't care whether it's Virginia or whether it's Idaho, whether it's Minnesota or Wisconsin. You're dealing with a culture that has, over time, been characterized as not emergency responders, but we're just doing our jobs. You know, snow and ice control or snow and ice management, you know, that's maintenance. And it's only over the last 10 years that we've been able to look back at them and say, no, you don't understand. This is about emergency response. This is as critical as a tornado when it hits you. But we have a very low, I don't want to call it low self-esteem, but what we look at ourselves as just maintenance staff, not to the stature that we look at our state police, our National Guard, the others who respond to those emergencies. This is about elevating that culture. It's also about, for the first time, deploying our practices statewide, uniformly, not just kind of growing it a district at a time. That's a significant different way of doing business than any other DOT has tried. Very frankly, in 2006 when I got here and in 2007, we implemented base realignment. It's called area headquarters. That was a major strategic move that is being supported now by this next wave, because everybody said, what's next? It's about utilizing those bases correctly now.
Ms. Conley?
I, too, like this very much, because not only will it help us to address these major incidents, the hazmat and the evacuations, but I see as a byproduct also that it will help us manage our congestion, whether it's caused by many fender benders or whatever it is. So I really think this is great. A lot of this is the underpinning is technology. And I know a lot of our technology throughout the state is aging, it's inadequate, and it is a big budget item. I know in Northern Virginia, particularly the decoder or message sign, they are old and they are weary and they're not going to work well in big incidents and they're not going to work well with controlling traffic. Do we see anything in our coming up six-year plan that we can get out there is part of your plan being funded? Because I see this as enormously important that we move forward as rapidly as possible, because it's the only answer we have right now to making the most of our capacity, which until there's a change of heart politically, or when there is it, but that's going to be a time lag. And some of these things we can move on right now.
Thank you. The first piece you will see of about the $300 million price tag, the first $60 million I can fund with internal readjustments. And as we deal with the service side of our maintenance budget, because I'll be redirecting how that money is being spent. Beyond that, the technology retrofit, you will begin to see in your six-year program documents. And it will compete, but it will be a priority against other kinds of spending, depending on how the next 8 weeks goes with discussions. Very frankly.
Could I follow up? So we might find in this upcoming six-year plan?
You'll see there are parts that are in the six-year plan. We're looking at our asset management part of the maintenance program, and I may be redirecting money within that in the next 12 months, because I will not allow the momentum to be lost in this initiative.
Okay, Ms. King.
My question would be, it's quite a diverse group that you pull together to have this readiness and response, and it's composed of several. One mentioned was contractors. What is the percentage of participation from a contractor's standpoint? And then at the same time,
are we in danger of losing some of the readiness from a private firm, or do we have a way to keep that up to date?
I can't give you a specific percentage. I can't. Of the 3,000 vehicles that we can deploy, about 40%, I think, are private sector contractors. So we have installed that within our business practices already. It's not something new that's coming along. So as we move forward, now we need to utilize that base. We will be, and that's why I indicated the TAMS contracts, we will be looking at those contracts. And one of the barriers, for instance, that we found is there are private sector operators who want to supplement our fleet, but they also need some guarantees that they're going to get used. That means you don't charge them to do business with us. And, in fact, we are charging them to do business with us. So we'll knock some of those barriers down. And it is about rapid utilization. Will the mix be consistent statewide? Can't predict that. It may be a different mix, depending on where you are in the Commonwealth. But the practice and the activities will be consistent.
Mr. Schwartz. Dave, I wanted to follow up on a point that Judy made, which I think is very important, that the piece of this that's, I'll call, accident response as opposed to major incident response really does go right back to the issue of congestion and road capacity, because accidents are a fact of life literally every day, every peak hour commute. And to a considerable extent, you're reliant on your working relationship with fire and rescue and local municipalities. I know out our way, you know, sometimes these guys are their own worst enemies, in that they, you know, even at $4 a gallon, they still like to roll out all the hardware. And so sometimes you get the very opposite, more than sometimes, of what you're talking about, which is over-response. And then that leads to its own set of problems. And, you know, I understand the issues they face of, in an emergency situation, needing to have what they need, and there's a communications issue to that, too. But I do think that over-response to minor incidents is a serious congestion-creating problem. And I'm just wondering whether you're looking at that and whether part of this training component is a way to deal with local and fire and rescue. And to mention to you that I think you have a natural ally in municipal governments here, because I think municipal governments are starting to recognize that they can save some money if they can get to this issue of over-response to minor incidents.
Absolutely, you're right on target.
Is that part of the
yes.
training thing is going to be? Okay.
Mr. Dickens.
Recommendation, sir. I would encourage you to do as much as you can to advise the public of what the evacuation plans are in the emergency response. And I'll tell you why. I've been in two meetings in the last couple of months where there were officials who should know, or maybe not should know, but who said things that were absolutely not correct about the evacuation system. And the reference was that the 64 was not for local people moving out. I didn't know the answer to the question, so I asked your folks, and I got a very detailed and way more in-depth answer than I thought was ever imagined, and I was very impressed with that. But I think the public needs to understand what these evacuation plans are, as well as the local elected people, not the elected people, but the local emergency response people. And I don't think I've seen that happen, and maybe you're doing more of that than I'm aware of. But it's going to be critical if we get in an emergency evacuation situation for me as a citizen or you as a citizen to know what's expected of you and where you're expected to go.
You've hit on a very, Mr. Chairman, you've hit on a very critical question, and that's the public responsibility and the public awareness piece. It's something that, as professionals within the department and within the community, we struggle with constantly. Because it is very hard to get people to deal with that whole concept that, in fact, this may happen. There's, you know, there's all of us tend to look around and say, haven't had a hurricane here for several years now, so we're okay. And but when it hits, you know, the governor on down has a very strong role to play in making our citizenry understand this is not a trivial activity. Lives are at risk, and we take that very seriously. So I appreciate the comment.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, our region here has a special interlock with the National Capital Region, and we're blessed with some highly imaginative professionals in our regional VDOT offices here, and there, several of them are, have leadership positions, actually, in making sure our region works. That's a little bit of a unique problem. Does what you're outlining here interlock pretty well with what our greater Washington region or the greater Northern Virginia region would be more precise?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Guillaume, yes, it does. There are two key facets that are very interesting in this, the spin-out of this activity. One, it re-highlights the regional context, particularly here in Northern Virginia, and in fact that is one of the focus areas that we'll be dealing with next week. And secondarily, as recently as this morning, I had a conversation with our partner on the Hot Lanes project about the need to make sure that our operations and emergency response plans are integrated, coordinated, and that the customer sees no difference between us and that operator of that facility. So very clearly, this is, you are absolutely right, Mortizai's staff is some of the best in the country in understanding this business and knowing what to do. And we're going to capitalize on that pretty heavily statewide.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Commissioner, thank you for undertaking this initiative. I would say to the CTB, there's a whole lot more here institutionally and organizationally than meets the eye. And one of the challenges that the commissioner is presenting to this body is to move to a functional as opposed to a geographic designation. You may hear from folks who are resistant to that change. And we need to support the commissioner in his efforts to reform and reorganize along these lines. This is what it's going to take in the 21st century to do our job. The next item, number five, is a quick review of the Transit Sustainability and Investment Program. Mr. Chip Badger will be here presenting even as the public hearing is being set up.
Mr. Chair, let me make a couple of comments.
Absolutely.
As he's getting set up, Mr. Badger is going to move expeditiously through the presentation. I think he's going to start at slide 8. I think what you want to do is focus in on the bottom line, that the policy that we're developing has a lot of work that goes under it to really support it. But when I think about it, we're trying to accomplish three things. We're trying to expand public transportation and do it in a cost-effective and efficient way. The second thing is we want to strengthen the whole six-year improvement program process. And the third thing is we want to make sure that as new investments come online, that they are matched with the transportation needs that they're trying to address. And I think this provides a policy framework for the Commonwealth Transportation Board to understand how we're going to look at projects, how we're going to do business, and how we're going to create even greater transparency by giving you critical pieces of information to understand what's coming before you in the annual six-year plan process.
Welcome, Mr. Badger.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I feel like I should be holding a guitar up here. Last month, we provided to you in your notebooks a copy of the Transit Sustainability and Investment Policy. At that time, I mentioned that we were providing that to you to take a look at, and that this month we would be coming back to you and going through that with you, and that next month in June we would ask you to adopt a resolution that accepts and enacts this policy. Since that time, we've sent this draft policy out to all the transportation, the transit systems in the Commonwealth, and we've also held three workshops, excuse me, where we went over a number of things, but we did talk about the policy at this workshop, at these workshops. And in fact, this presentation is the presentation that we used for our grantees. The first half of the presentation basically was designed to explain to our grantees why we're doing this, so they didn't think this is just a whim of DRPT. All of these things are documents or presentations that you have seen before, so I'm going to skip forward with this and go to the meat of the presentation, which is, in fact, slide 9. Again, this policy is in your, at your place. This is essentially the same policy that we showed you last month. We have received comment from a couple of our transit systems on this, and we're receiving comments until the 30th of May, and we will be making some changes to this. We have some good suggestions and observations so far. Our policy statement, the purpose of our policy statement is to set out a framework that's going to serve as the basis of our recommendations to you on how to invest state and federal funds for public transportation. And we expect, in addition to having this policy statement serve as our guiding principles, we expect the statement will help you and our grantees understand what it is that we'll be looking for when we get proposals for new or expanded public transportation services. We expect that if our grantees understand our evaluation tools better, we will probably receive higher quality, better thought out proposals. Now, we do not intend to use this policy statement to screen out projects or to tell transit operators what they're supposed to do. But any recommendation that we make to you on investment will address all of the principles set out in this policy. We identified three goals in this policy. First, to increase transit ridership per capita by at least 3% annually. Now, this is not, we're not talking about a 3% growth per year in just pure ridership, but a per capita increase. You have to understand there's a lot of Virginians that do not have access to public transportation. And this is not the same percentage that you might hear about growth in ridership. But we're trying to stay ahead of population growth and actually have more people use transportation, public transportation, routinely. We also have identified maintaining the existing transportation assets as a top priority. And, of course, we want anything we do to support improved land use, protect our environment, and maximize the use of the funds that we do have available. We also identified four core principles for the policy. We think it's essential that both our program and our transit systems individually are financially sustainable. We intend to identify quantifiable service needs for any new investment proposals, and we also want to make sure that local participation will be there to sustain any new investments. We, of course, will make sure that any new services are efficient and are integrated with other transit systems or services and with other modes. And as a bottom line, of course, we want to make sure that any of our investments produce improved quality of life for Virginia citizens. Now, this is a list of the tools that we're going to be using to enforce these policies. First is asset management. This is a new program we're developing. It'll be a computerized program where we are going to have an inventory of all the transit vehicles and equipment in operation in Virginia. We'll know the type of equipment, its useful life, when it was purchased, its current condition, and we'll be able to predict exactly when things will need to be replaced or go in for major overhauls. We're also producing service design guidelines. This is going to be a document that's going to explain what types of socioeconomic, demographic, market, operational environments make sense for different types of transit services. This is not intended to prevent anybody from coming in with a proposal for something new, but it's going to show what works best in what circumstances. And it'll also establish some performance expectations. If you're going to start a new transit service, it's reasonable to expect it's going to carry about this many people, depending on the type of service you're trying to implement. We're also going to be formalizing the process we use for evaluating capital projects. We will be continue to look at project readiness and making sure there's sufficient justification and clear need for any proposals. We're going to be incorporating our asset management program in the capital application evaluation. Somebody's proposing to replace the piece of equipment. We'll be able to use our asset management to verify that, yes, it has reached its useful life or it's due for a major overhaul. And we'll be developing program guidance so that our grantees know just exactly what it is we'll be doing as part of this process. We are incorporating maintenance of effort. Last month, when I presented the draft public transportation program to you, we talked about this. And I mentioned at that point in time for the draft program, we used the definition of maintenance of effort that looked at local spending in fiscal year 08 as compared to fiscal year 09. This is one item where we received a lot of comment from our transit community. And we're taking another look at that. We're looking at different metrics that might be used and possibly just a different way of looking at how we define maintenance of effort. We'll have a very specific proposal on that and bring that to you next month with the revised final draft of the six-year improvement program. We're also developing program guidance, and this is one of the things that was very well received by our grantees. We are going to put in writing all the processes and procedures that we use to receive, evaluate, award grants, make payments, close out grants, and make it very clear what everybody is supposed to do and on what timeline. And this is something they were very excited to hear about. We're also going to be implementing a public benefit analysis of major new projects or service initiations. It'll be similar to what we do in the rail enhancement program, but it'll be a little bit broader. We won't be taking trucks off the road, obviously, with public transportation. And there are a lot of social benefits to public transportation that we're going to capture in our public benefit analysis. We think that the policy that we've drafted for you is going to produce a number of benefits, both to us and to our public transportation systems. We believe that it's going to lead to the more efficient use of the resources that we have. Very clearly, we're going to be committed to providing technical assistance as we make more definitive expectations on our transit systems to what they have to present to justify a project. We want to be there to help them do that, both with our own staff and with consultants. We believe that through these processes I've talked about, we're going to have dependable, demonstrable data that show what's being achieved through public transportation. And very clearly, we'll have better needs for our six-year improvement program. The asset management program alone should capture a lot of capital projects that don't show up in our six-year program right now. We also think that it'll help our grantees by providing much more dependable levels of state participation in capital funding. We think it'll increase the accountability of our agency for how we manage the state's and federal government's resources, and it'll add to the transparency of the administration of our agency. Timeline for the fiscal year 2009 allocations, as I mentioned, we will be incorporating maintenance of effort. We use one definition for the draft program, and we'll be reevaluating that and possibly doing something slightly different for the final program. By June 30th, 2009, we'll be reporting to the governor and to you and the General Assembly on how we've incorporated all of the principles. And for the fiscal year 2010 program, we will actually be incorporating all these principles in the recommendations we make to you for new grants. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Mr. Manager. Mr. White.
Thank you. I think this is good, Chip, what you all are proposing. You made reference to it earlier, and that is you have discussed the provisions of this with stakeholders in Virginia. Can you comment in a little more detail of how that procedure has played out, and is there a list of stakeholders you have discussed this proposal with?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We've had three sessions, one in Roanoke, one in Richmond, one in Northern Virginia. And I haven't seen the attendance list, but I believe just about all of the transit properties have sent people to this. We talked about this policy and a lot of other things we're doing, both performance evaluation, financial reviews, new data requirements. We are asking a lot more of our transit operators. It has to do with providing information to us so that we can report it to to you and to the General Assembly and to the public on how we're doing. It is some additional work on their part. We don't think it's unreasonable. We have talked about the maintenance of effort requirement. Like I say, we've gotten some feedback on that and some suggestions as to how we might do that differently. Like I say, I think overall we've had more positive comments than we have had negative, but they're wary until we put all this into effect and see how it actually works.
Yeah. Follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think we all agree that's certainly understandable, and I have not heard from anybody in my district yay or nay on this, but like with other policies, we're going to be asked to vote on this at some point. And with other policies we've put in place, we've had a list of those stakeholders, and I would appreciate a summary of what the negative comments might be so that we're informed at least before we vote.
We absolutely would do that. Anybody that gives us comments in writing, and I know of at least two that will do that, we will provide you both the comments that we receive and our response to them.
Right.
Anything we get in writing, any notes that we have from these sessions, we'll put those into written form and give those to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you very much. I just want to make an observation. With using words like reliable, predictable, dependable, it appears to me that really your underlying goal is to reestablish trust in the entire system between DRPC and the General Assembly, between the state and localities, between the operators and the customers. And that's something that's been missing. You definitely have impressed upon us how sensitive an operator has to be to that reliability, dependability, and if we can actually advance that whole rebuilding of trust. Maybe we have a model for a lot of other things in government, too. So
that's certainly our goal.
Ms. Conn.
I was absent at the last meeting, and you may have covered it, but under your core principles to develop a financially sustainable transit program, that is a wonderful goal. As we all know, transit does need support. And how do you, therefore, define a sustainable transit program, or is that in the development stage, or do you use any specific criteria?
Well, I think what we're getting at there is some of the terminology that Mr. Coulomb used, predictable, reliable, something, a state program that they can count on. Also, we want to make sure that anything we start can be continued. We don't want to invest in a new public transportation system that when we take a look at the financial needs 5 or 6 years down the road, there needs to be a very good expectation that the funds will be there to keep it going.
All
so
right.
It's both our own program and the systems themselves.
Oh, I see. So it's not only our commitment to the system, but the systems making their best effort to be financially as sound as possible.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Badger. The next item on the agenda, item number 5, is a quick review of the revenue sharing program goals. This program set of program guidelines was adopted at our last meeting. Mr. Bowie, I believe, asked for an opportunity to discuss these and have them presented in a little more detail than we had time for at our last meeting. Welcome, Mr. Estes. You have a guitar to the microphone there, I hope.
I won't entertain anyone today. I'll do this. I will say that I understand brevity is usually rewarded here, so I will seek rewards tonight and just very briefly go through what I think is a program that everyone here at the board has been engaged in for some time and just walk through kind of where we are. This is the third time I've been in front of the board in as many months on this program, so this is a good valued milestone for us to kind of move this program forward. Basically, after the General Assembly updated the program earlier this year, we came to you with the General Assembly update and gave a brief overview of what happened in the General Assembly last month. Again, as the chairman mentioned, you guys approved the policy, and now in front of you hopefully is the program guide that goes with that policy. I won't spend much time on the background. Again, most of you are very familiar with this program. It's a matching program, very popular program with our local government partners. It is up to $1 million a few years ago per locality. And I'll spend a little bit of time about the tiers here in a few minutes. some of the changes, and this has really changed from the code, and this is something like Ms. Carter we were talking about earlier. These are really the code changes, and the focus of the program that came out of the General Assembly has been on to improve, reconstruct, or construct highway facilities. Did take away some of the emphasis on the maintenance side of the house. I'll talk about the tiers on the next slide. Did put in, I think, a really good requirement on requiring the proper use of the money in a adequate time period, similar to how we the board's policy is on the enhancement program. Does give some flexibility on the use of VDOT forces if the locality does administer a job. Took away some of that inflexibility use of the proper funds, puts that back in place. Local governments can use basically wherever they want to get the money from the match, that's up to them. And then again, it codifies that funding limit of the previous ceiling of $15 million and the our previous floor of $15 million and ceiling of $50 million. Real quickly or briefly on the tier system, again, this is probably what you've heard about before in the past. It does eliminate the previous first tier that gave priority to those local governments who were committing over $1 million to get $1 million from the state. What it does now for priority number one is it says locally administered projects are going to be our priority number one. Again, that's very much dovetails with the business plan of the department. And then it goes to priority two for those localities that are matching more than they're asking for. But it doesn't come with that stipulation that it has to be over $1 million. So, for example, it could be a smaller locality that just wants to match a little bit more to then get, say, $50,000 or $100,000 from the state.
Mr. Chairman, a quick question on number one. How many localities are able to locally administer revenue sharing funds?
It's a great question, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davis, during the General Assembly session when those questions were coming up, we did take a quick look at the previous years. And already we've got anywhere from, I believe the percentages was up to almost, I think it's 40 to 50% of the existing program was being locally administered already. So it is already a substantial part of the program. But one of the things I'll talk about in a minute, I'll just go ahead and skip down to it, that orange statement about the enactment clause that came with the new language. We're going to put off, or the General Assembly decided to put off the enactment of locally administered projects for 1 year. To allow that kind of ramp up from a local government perspective to make sure that they're able to do that a year from now.
Very good.
I want to dovetail on what he just said. If 40, 50% of the existing program currently falls under that, that means 50% is not locally administered, so they completely fall off once this gets implemented. They'd no longer be eligible to do it unless they could stand up that capability.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sterling, the approach would be that those projects are already approved by this board. Those are existing projects, so it would be new applications from here forward.
Yeah, but those municipalities would no longer be eligible unless they could stand up that capability. And then if you look at, because that obviously didn't, all localities did not receive funding in the existing programs, how many of the localities within the Commonwealth truly do not have this capability? And I would guess that there's some of the smaller communities.
To bluntly answer the first part of the question, yes, locally administered projects are going to be the first priority. So those who choose not to try to locally administer a project would not fall under that first priority. So they would be potentially down to another priority. Again, we are working. We have like a local partnership team that works with training those local governments on administering these jobs. The beauty of the revenue sharing program is it's a 100% state-funded program. So it's a great starting point for local governments who haven't administered projects in the past because it doesn't come with those federal strings that a lot of those local governments are having trouble with on the locally administered side of the house. So we do see this as a great way to kind of get that program started for some of those smaller rural localities who may not have done that in the past. Again, the additional flexibility that the General Assembly added to where VDOT can come in and, for example, if a locality says, look, I can manage that contract, but I really have no experience doing any kind of environmental coordination or something like that, there is the flexibility for VDOT to come in and do that work on behalf of the local government.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. White.
On priority number two, projects for which the locality commits more local funding than the amount of revenue sharing funding requested, I guess that means that if they request $100,000 from the state and their local share is $100,001. That puts them in priority two.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. White, yes, sir, that's correct.
So there that is no limit as right. to what a minimal amount is over the match.
So that is, in effect, going to eliminate priorities 3 and 4 because every locality would be willing to put in a dollar more. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman, well, I do believe that, you know, that is an it's a potential for this, but my blunt opinion is, again, that I believe that priority 1 will consume a majority of the program because of the mass interest in the program in previous years. Just with my experience, I think that most local governments are going to make sure they're going to meet that first priority and make sure they can take advantage of getting really $2 for every dollar they put up.
And everything left will go in priority 2.
Again, that's just kind of looking at the crystal ball a little bit. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Mr. Davis.
I know I had a lot to say about this earlier, so I'll be very brief this time. I really appreciate taking the number one item out, but I think your number two that was moved up to number one, in effect, does the same thing that one did, and I still don't think it's right to limit this fund because of the size and the wealth of a county or city, and that's exactly what you're doing. So I still object to that and wish there were a way not to do that. I understand the need of the department to have self-administration because of the amount of staff and the work that's required, and I worry about that. So I do understand that concern. But I don't think it's fair to penalize a county or a city or town simply because they're not as wealthy as the others or because they can't come up with the staff to administer the fund. So I wish there were an alternative to having all the money go to priority one, which is what's going to happen. And there are going to be a lot of counties that are not going to be eligible for it. Fortunately, in my area, I learned that quite a few are eligible, and I appreciated learning that, and that made me feel a little bit better. But I still know there are a lot that will not.
If the board would permit a little editorializing here, a couple of things. The first is, it takes as much time and effort oftentimes to manage a little project as a big project.
Right.
And this VDOT is down to, what, 8,500 employees. When I started as deputy secretary, we were about 10,700 employees. We're a much, much smaller agency. Secondly, priorities. We spent a long time talking about maintenance deficit. So, you know, we need to always put this in context. Third, I would say, as one who started a road building program for a county and was told this is very hard, you can't possibly do it, and then went out and did it and turned out it really wasn't all that hard, it's just like anything, you apply yourself. And I suspect that a jurisdiction that has the additional resources, the $500,000 and $1 million to put into a transportation project probably has the available staff resources to undertake this kind of work. And this is the kind of expertise we need to grow, and in many respects has been retarded because VDOT does it all. And it's good to have a variety of public sector entities that can manage a variety of public works projects, including transportation and drainage as well.
My final comment, I understand that, I think, earlier and said that I really do believe it's wise to figure out how we can have them self-administered. And maybe some provision while you're working on this delay for 1 year of having the locality that cannot pay VDOT for those services at somehow to reimburse that cost might be a way of making eligible Bath County, for instance, that wants to make some drainage improvements, but they don't have enough people working for Bath County to be able to take this on. Maybe they could contract back with you and pay for the services that are needed to make it possible. I just keep looking for ways to make this fair across all the jurisdictions you're dealing with, and I applaud your efforts for doing that. I really do.
Or private sector contract.
But you still need a public sector owner.
Yes.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Mr. Kumay, last comment, and then we're going to move along.
Yeah, I just had a question, though. I haven't been on this board that long, but it's still, to me, there's a confusion of the intent of this program versus other programs. The way I've understood this program is it's actually meant to use state funds to attract the maximum
local
number of local dollars. So that's why the priorities tend to do that. It's really to
It's really to use a little state money to get to try to get more local money. There are other programs and formulas by which we distribute other funds to, you know, whether it's special needs and ongoing needs and other kinds of things. So am I wrong in that? That's still a fundamental underlying purpose of this particular program as opposed to all of our programs.
I think that's fair assessment.
Fair to say, yes, sir.
Okay, we've got another hearing started, so let's move along at a rapid clip, if we
may. Rapid clip means I will skip priority 3 and 4 because you've seen those before. Really, this is the meat on the program guide. And in summary, basically, the program guide, this board approved that over, I guess it was 2 years ago when the General Assembly changed the code provision in 2006. We simply updated that to reflect those changes that came out of this past session, clarified a few things, put some focus again on the timely completion of projects, and then just again added some clarity as to what we were looking for as to what would be eligible projects. Next steps, we plan to put the guide out for public consumption by the end of the week. We'll send out letters hopefully next week. If you recall, we put this FY09 application call on hold back in March. So, and when I did that, we committed to the local governments that we'd give them at least 2 months to respond, get it through their local councils, local board of supervisors. So we'll put a deadline out there for August 1 with the hope of coming back to the board as a workshop item as to what we've heard and what we plan to bring to you as an action item in November for approval of the actual allocations to the local governments. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Estes. Any final questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Is it 100 million max, 50 million max?
It's 50 million state, 50 million local.
Is there any logic in increasing that to attract more state dollars if that's the focus? And I'm not real familiar with how all this works.
Well, one, it is funded with the bond proceeds, so in 10 years this program goes away completely, along with our ability to match federal dollars. So we need to keep all this in perspective. You know, secondly, one needs to stand back and ask, when we're wrestling with our fundamental priorities of just maintaining existing, I think at the end of the day, this is a great program. It helps a number of localities. It does bring local dollars to the table. But is it our most important priority? I mean, we're rapidly getting to the point where we're going to ask the question, do we do a matching program with localities? Do we match our federal dollars so that we don't leave Virginia tax dollars on the table? Do we properly maintain existing infrastructure? And so we don't face that challenge today, but the last 6-year program that this body will adopt, well, I'm chair, we'll start to ask those questions. We will see those on the horizon, and those are going to be tough. Thank you, Mr. Estes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board.
The next presentation is by Mr. Tom Farney. Tom is the statewide BRAC coordinator, and while he's coming up and getting queued up, Tom, you've forgotten your guitar. I just wanted to... I know we have are blessed with many talents on this board, but Cord Sterling has really volunteered in a statewide capacity to help Virginia deal with the statewide impacts of BRAC, which are very significant in Virginia. And I think all of us would probably have preferred to see some different decisions come out of that BRAC commission, but it's our job to manage those and manage them in a way that is productive to Virginia's largest employer and that helps us to meet the national security needs of our nation. And Cord has gotten us to places where we would not have been able to get and educated us. It's been really a very, very fruitful partnership. The commissioner saw the wisdom of designating a single point of contact for all of these transportation issues, and Mr. Farney has brought some great highway, transit, land use, and institutional experience to the table. So he's here to give us a quick overview of the entire range of BRAC activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't agree with you more on Mr. Sterling's help with the BRAC program. He's been invaluable in this process. If you recall, last time I updated you on BRAC, it was last July in Fredericksburg, after Secretary Homer took you on a three-hour bus ride, a cross-country bus ride, and now I'm holding up dinner. So I'll try to go through this as quickly as possible. Here's a map that shows the eight installations that are gaining people in the Commonwealth. It ranges from about 600 at Langley Air Force Base to 19,000 at Fort Belvoir. When we last met in July of last year, there were three big projects we were focusing on. We've added a fourth, Fort Monroe, which we'll talk about a little bit later. As far as Quantico is concerned, in July of last year, the draft environmental impact statement was not yet released, and the only funding commitment we had for transportation was a small grant for bus shelters. Since then, both the draft and final EISs have been published. We have a commitment from the Department of Navy to spend about $3 million to fix the I-95 Russell Road interchange. We expect the record of decision in June. We don't expect the Marines to offer up any other road money to mitigate the impacts of their development. It's a list of some key improvements that have not been addressed, most notably the Onville Road widening, which provides access to a gate on the west side of Quantico. Fort Lee last year was a little more advanced when I gave this briefing. Their record decision had already been signed. Localities and state had allocated a significant amount of money towards improving the off-base road problems associated with this BRAC development. Since then, the commanding officer has submitted some defense access road requests for some BRAC projects. Only one of those projects was determined to be eligible, and that was a roundabout at the A Avenue gate. VDOT was asked to provide a cost estimate on that project, and we agreed to administer it once the Army provides the funding. Unfortunately, in this year's defense appropriations bill, there is no money allocated for that project. We're hopeful in the FY10 budget there will be money. Again, some key improvements that have not been addressed at Fort Lee. Fort Belvoir is the second largest in terms of relocating employees, the second largest BRAC project in the country. Back in July, they were planning on moving 22,000 people to the fort. Their preferred alternative included 18,000 of those people relocating to about a 500-acre property that they own called the Engineer Proving Grounds. We had committed over $200 million to fix some road problems in that area, one of which is under construction, the I-95 Fourth Lane project, and the Fairfax County Parkway project, both directly benefiting Fort Belvoir. The preferred land use alternative required an additional $500 million worth of improvements to mitigate those impacts. The Army made no commitments to fund any of those improvements, and basically we were stalled on the Fairfax County Parkway extension memorandum of agreement. So last July it was not a good picture at Fort Belvoir. Since then we've made some progress. They've issued their record of decision. They've reduced the number of employees from 22 down to 19,000, and they deferred a decision on the location of 6,200 employees of the Washington Headquarters Services. In September and October, they had groundbreakings for two buildings, one the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and the expansion of the DeWitt Hospital. That was before the Fairfax County Parkway agreement had ever been entered into. In December, we made substantial progress, and we brought to you the memorandum of agreement with the Army and the Federal Highway, which you approved in concept. Some key points are that the agreement caps the number of employees at the Engineer Proving Grounds to 8,500. The Army can come back to us if they want to put more development on EPG, but they have to negotiate transportation improvements just like any other developer would. FHWA agreed to to administer the design-build contract using our funds, and we got 155 acres of donated property for the parkway, and hopefully that's clean right of way. In January of 2008, the Defense Access Road Program certified three projects totaling $36 million. So the Army is chipping in $36 million of the half-billion-dollar need at Fort Belvoir. Continuing in February, the MOA was signed by the commissioner and it was formally executed. Next week, FHWA is issuing the request for proposals for the design-build contract for the parkway. In June or July, we expect the Army to recommend a location for those 6,200 employees of the WHS. August, they're due to make a decision. They're down to three sites, two of which are in Alexandria. The other is in Springfield at the GSA warehouse site. We're hopeful they'll pick a site that has good transit access and existing transit service. The goal in October, November, we're going to bring to you the FHWA's award, recommended award of the design-build contract, and the goal is to complete the parkway project by December 2010, which coincides with the opening of the first NGA building. A whole list of improvements that have not been addressed at Fort Belvoir. Fort Monroe's the new kid on the block. Last July, it really was not on our radar screen. It's a base closure, but in the same year, in 2007, the General Assembly had created a redevelopment authority. 18 members, including five cabinet secretaries, does not include Secretary Homer. The chairman is Secretary Bryant from Natural Resources. We got wind that some of the development scenarios at Fort Monroe could contain as much as 2,300 residential units and over 1 million square feet of non-residential development. They did perform a traffic study, but they didn't look at the impacts outside of the road system of the fort. We're very concerned about the impacts to I-64, and we've asked to be involved now in the process. Their public hearing is scheduled for May 28th on their reuse plans. They plan to approve their reuse plan in June. That will be sent to the governor for approval and then to the Army. The NEPA documentation, they've already started that process. We expect a much more detailed traffic study to be performed as part of that NEPA process. They're looking at July to issue a record of decision. The bottom line here is that we're at least $400 million short in terms of funding the transportation improvements associated with BRAC. I can tell you that number will go up. We don't know what's going to come out of the Fort Monroe development. Plus, the Fort Belvoir cost estimates are only construction estimates. They don't include right-of-way or utility relocation. Best guess is somewhere between a half billion and $750 million. Wanted to touch briefly on the Defense Access Road Program. This is the program that Mr. Sterling has been very helpful with in assisting VDOT in trying to change the criteria of DAR. It is the DOD policy that determines whether or not they can spend Department of Defense money on public road improvements. That policy was last updated in 1991. And you can see the commonly used criteria. The one that we have the most trouble with is the doubling of traffic, meaning that the development that takes place at the installation has to double traffic in order to meet the DAR criteria, which is virtually impossible in areas like Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. There's been a couple congressionally mandated studies on BRAC. The first one has been completed, and then the Government Accountability Office determined that it was too early to determine the transportation impacts of BRAC. We disagree with that. We have traffic studies that show otherwise. The second is a study that's just getting underway. Mr. Sterling and I met with the GAO project managers just last week on this. Mr. Sterling developed some legislation in an attempt to change the DAR criteria. And what it would do is require the Department of Defense to fund the pro rata share of road improvements, meaning if they add 50% of the traffic to an intersection, they would pay for 50% of the cost to upgrade that intersection, but only if those intersections or roads were at a level service E or F. That's traditionally how we treat developers. We would apply that to the military as well. But most importantly, it would be retroactive to the 2005 BRAC projects. Just a week or two ago, we got an indication that the Armed Services Committee had approved legislation, the Senate Armed Services Committee had approved legislation that would require the Secretaries of Defense and Transportation to review the current criteria and submit a report to Congress later this year. It requires an analysis of whether or not a separate military construction account should be created. Right now, if a project is certified by DAR, it has to compete with other projects within the military budget. Just because you're certified through DAR doesn't mean you get funding by DOD. It also requires a review of the measurement tools for assessing the eligibility for DAR projects. And this gets into, should the criteria be doubling of traffic or the more traditional level of service? And it requires recommendations for changes to those criteria. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions or comments? Mr. Stern, thank you once again for all your help. Any additional comments you'd like to make?
Not a problem. We were told today that the House Armed Services Committee has done something as well. We don't know what that is. Hopefully we'll see that. It's been a few days. I really have got to acknowledge Tom's help on this. I mean, we sat down with staff members and other people and really informed them on what the traditional way that you measure whether there's going to be a problem and who should contribute funds to the system based on levels of service versus these arbitrary figures that, you know, DOD MILCON people have done used for years, which are meaningless when it comes to actual transportation. It's been tremendously helpful. Couldn't have done any of it without Tom. Again, we're only partway there. We've got a long way to go forward before we get the, you know, the goal ultimately is to get a large part of those $400 million or so paid for through the federal government, which caused this problem, but we'll see.
Quick question, Mr. Chair. Is Congressman Forbes involved in helping out?
We've asked him to. He is the ranking member on the subcommittee that has jurisdiction over this. We do know we've gotten Congressman Moran has taken this up within the House the most stridently. He made it his number one policy issue. We know that Congressman Whitman submitted it. Congressman Ford has not indicated whether he'll, you know, what his stance is on it. I think the markup that we see coming out would be a good indication on where he was on that particular issue, whether we're getting that support or not.
He's been very good on certain things that I've talked to him about that have nothing to do with transportation, though, but other stuff. And he's on the Armed Services Committee and should be able to get his help somehow here.
One of the challenges is that in previous meetings, the staff had clearly indicated that they saw this as a state responsibility, that we needed to fund this. And that's, you know, we walked them through it and we walked the congressman through it. So I suspect where they are today on that.
Okay, additional questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Farney. I'd just like to close this topic out by saying we have known unmet BRAC needs, and this factors into the public hearings on the six-year program of $500 million for BRAC. One of the issues in the Hampton Roads area is to add the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, and their commissioner has a study underway to look at that. And one of the things we have tried to do with BRAC is to connect transportation and land use in a very direct way. And there's such large land uses, it's actually kind of easy to do that. We are, as we were looking at Fort Belvoir and capping the density on that site to a level that can be served, that's an important, very important objective that we were able to achieve. Not easy, with a lot of hard work. I would suggest to Mr. Dickens and Mr. Witt to pay very, very close attention to Fort Monroe. Think about what adding 1 million square feet, a couple thousand, several thousand residential units to Fort Monroe will do to I-64 and the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel.
And we understand that there are economic development implications of that, but there are serious to severe transportation impacts associated with that. So thank you. That concludes the workshop. Let me just say, before everybody gets up and leaves, because we have 2 minutes left here, what we're going to do is we have dinner ready in the back room. What I would suggest is, why don't people clear their places here, if you will, and we'll start the public hearing maybe at 5:35. Just take a few minutes to clean up your space. And what I would suggest is either make some phone calls, refresh yourself, go outside, get a breath of fresh air, or listen to the public hearings on the subdivision street ordinance. That'll start at 5:35. And why don't, yes, it's right here in this room. And then at 6 o'clock, behind that wall there, there's a door, and there's a small dining room where they've got some buffet where we can eat. And we have our public hearing on the Northern Virginia six-year program at 7:30 right here in this location. So you will come back to these places. But, it'll be two people taking comments from folks on the subdivision street regulations here in just a minute. So the work session is adjourned. We will